You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my tremendous privilege this week to welcome back to Talk Nation Radio Dennis Kucinich. He has been mayor of Cleveland, Ohio State Senator, 8-term member of the U.S. Congress, 2-time presidential candidate, and I'm tempted to say, despite all of that, a consistent principled advocate for peace. You can find him at Kucinich.com and at Facebook.com/Dennis Kucinich. Dennis, welcome back to Talk Nation Radio.
David, thank you, and thank you for that very kind introduction. It's important that we speak at this moment because our nation and the world is in peril.
There are so many wars and so many crimes and so much militarization. Let's start with Syria. What is your view of what's happening there?
The United States, under the Trump administration, has launched an illegal, unconstitutional attack on Syria, even without the permission of Congress. President Trump's state sending troops to Syria is problematic. There's no authorization for that. Congress has to authorize the movement of the country from a condition of peace to a condition of war. Article 1, Section 8 makes that abundantly clear. Series of presidents have basically ignored the Constitution and done pretty much as they please, with the only speed bump being the War Powers Resolution, which may in itself be unconstitutional, but the fact of the matter is the president proceeded without congressional approval. We're in Syria right now. And not only are we in Syria with respect to the appearance of military, but we've been in Syria for quite a few years through the Central Intelligence Agency manipulating behind the scenes to oust the current government.
Yeah, so it seems to me, Dennis, that when Barack Obama was president, the United States was sending weapons to Syria, sending troops to Syria, dropping bombs from airplanes and drones on Syria. All of that's been going on for some years, hasn't it?
It has, and funding so-called moderates who, when they're unmasked, turned out to be variations of Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, and ISIS. So one has to ask what the ultimate game has been in Syria of the Washington defense contractor establishment, and it certainly isn't the stabilization of the government. It certainly isn't the civil and human rights of the Syrian people. It's about something else, and it's about regime change and about a continuation of the disastrous policies which have taken America into the Middle East and has resulted in the slaughter of over a million people.
I'm a huge fan of anything that will wake people up, make people pay attention, get people active, but I find it really curious that the use of chemical weapons, whoever uses them, is treated as somehow dramatically worse than the use of bombs or missiles or napalm or depleted uranium or cluster bombs. Is there something worse about the use of chemical weapons, and does it justify the escalated use of all kinds of other weapons if it happens?
Well, you raise an important philosophical question, and that is it only the way people are killed that's objectionable, or is it objectionable that people are killed in a war that's based on lies? Certainly the gas attack in Idlib was horrible, as was the gas attack in Ghouta in 2013 and other gas attacks in Syria that preceded that. But a couple of things need to be kept in mind. Number one, in the last month, the United States has been bombing areas in Syria and in Iraq, which has resulted in the death of over 1,000 civilians. Those civilians' claims on life were just as valid as those who were victimized in the attack on Ghouta and Idlib. So the problem is the war itself. Now, let's go a little bit deeper. The one huge concern that I have about this entire matter is the rush to judgment and the conclusory action taken without any even interest in gathering evidence. To me, that smacks of an agenda. It doesn't really talk about, you know, relate to trying to protect people. It's like one of those off-the-shelf actions that's very similar to how we got into Iraq. Somebody had something ready to go, didn't have anything to do with Iraq, but a policy that blamed Iraq and then proceeded to annihilate Iraq. I'm very concerned, David, that that the United States, big-hearted people are getting suckered into a larger war based on manufactured consent from that comes only from a lack of evidence and a lack of interest in getting any evidence.
Yeah, I've appreciated your work over the years, Denis Kucinich, of course, in exposing the lack of evidence before the invasion of Iraq in 2003 and numerous other false cases for war. But I want to get clear, would there be anything legal or moral or practical about the United States bombing Syria now, even if there were evidence and it were made public and it were presented to Congress?
No. Absolutely not. Under the UN Charter, Article 51, no nation has a right to wage aggressive war against another nation. And if there is a attack of, against people of a nation, and the government of that nation doesn't want to do anything about it or is instrumental in it, that's an issue for the UN Security Council. And no nation has a right to act alone.
Yeah.
Unilateralism, preemption, first strike doctrine, which America has embraced, particularly after 9/11, puts us in enduring danger because we are creating more enemies around the world by the shoot first, ask questions later approach. And there, as you point out, there is no justification under international law or even moral law for the United States to come forward and decide to arbitrarily bomb Syria, and the other point is, what we don't know is the extent to which the Trump administration is being played by forces within the defense establishment. And I want to cite something for a minute, David, and I want to go back to you for a question.
Sure.
I'd like your listeners to remember that in October of 2016, the Obama administration sent Secretary John Kerry to meet with Foreign Minister Lavrov of Russia to come up with an agreement in over a ceasefire in Syria. And they came to an agreement. The Pentagon and the CIA bitterly complained publicly through their ever-present sources that they didn't want to engage in cooperation militarily or intelligence sharing with Russia. A few days later, even after an agreement was reached between Russia and the United States, a Syrian army barracks was bombed. 100 Syrian soldiers were killed. That ended this very brief agreement between Russia and the United States that could have put us on a path to peace in the region. Now, if President Obama was totally engaged and wasn't on his way out the door, he should have dismissed the head of the CIA and the Secretary of Defense because they obviously were trying to sabotage the agreement that would have been a first step towards peace. So we have to be aware that the Trump administration could very well be at the mercy of these forces inside the state. Because the fact of the matter is he doesn't have the experience in dealing with these elements. He does not have any clue as to the games that can be played. And he himself could be easily manipulated by these elements into military action.
Yeah. I don't think there is any excuse, however, for Obama's failing to act, as you suggest, or for Trump's failing to act in that manner now. And what do you make of this attitude among most members of Congress, most employees of the corporate media, most powerful people in Washington, D.C., and the Democratic and Republican parties, that important people swear they have evidence and we should just trust them?
Yeah, right. We were there in Iraq. We've been there in Libya. It's illegal. There's a real possibility of a false flag. The rush to judgment suggests that there was premeditation here. The fact that the CIA has been in Syria for years always raises the question of manipulation.
Yeah.
Washington's interested in proxy wars, so Syria ends up being a stage for a battle with Iran and Russia and maybe China at this point. This is insanity. And, you know, what I say to those who in Washington in 2017 is the same thing I said to those in Washington in 2002. Wake up, look at the facts. Don't rush to judgment. Don't get us into a war. Don't kill innocent people. Don't put our troops at risk. Do keep your responsibility first and foremost to the United States without getting us into foreign intrigues and wars that are based on lies. So, you know, David, in October 2002, I did a very deep analysis of the situation with respect to Iraq and saw there was no proof whatsoever to take us into war against Iraq. And I shared that information in a document with the members of Congress. The document can still be researched on October 2nd, 2002, Kucinich's analysis of the war in Iraq.
Yeah.
And you know what? I mean, here we are, 15 years later. We're still doing the same thing. It's like Groundhog Day with respect to war.
Yeah.
We keep going back to war based on lies, to foreign interventions that are willful and self-defeating. And, we the people have to respond. This calls for a national mobilization, people, for us to go back to the streets, to go to congressional offices and to say we are not going to be tricked again into another war, or we're not going to be forced into another war. If, in fact, there was some kind of gas attack that the government was responsible for, that's a matter for international investigation and for The Hague. It is not for the United States of America or any president of the United States of America to play prosecutor, judge, jury, executioner, as part of a position of world imperialism or dominance. We really have to get out of that, because otherwise we'll destroy this country and the world itself is in jeopardy.
I think so. It seems like to me, as far as Groundhog Day repetitions, the closest repetition here in history is 2013, in which the Obama administration, or members of the establishment attempting to play the Obama administration, made a very similar case and said, here's a chemical attack. We swear we knew who did it. You'll have to trust us. But there wasn't the same immediate rush to action. There was a delay, and Congress members, as now, were in their districts, and they started hearing from people at town hall meetings and getting more phone calls and emails than ever before, and the Parliament in the United Kingdom opposed a war for the first time ever, and President Obama, largely because of public pressure, backed off. Here you have a repetition, and we've never seen any evidence, over the past 3 years. Here you have a repetition, but this greater pretense of urgency. Let's act before anybody is able to investigate the facts or the lack thereof. How do we stop that? How do you compare these two incidents, 2013 and now?
Well, let's look at 2013. I've got a book that I'm looking at right now called Inside Syria, and it's by Reese Ehrlich, E-R-L-I-C-H.
He's been on this show.
Well, Reese, in his investigation and in his research on the gas attack, points out, and I'm going to quote directly from his book. He talks about you know, he says, he talks about the claims that were made, and then he says, on the other hand, if UN Inspector Sellstrom, as well as professors from MIT and Tesla Lab, are correct on the rocket trajectory, the rockets were fired from areas very near to or under rebel control. So he raises the point in his book that it's just as possible that the opposition to the Assad government, which includes al-Qaeda, al-Nusra, ISIS, fighters from over 90 countries, that they, in fact, could have initiated the gas attack, and that the fact that there is there's been no investigation, we cannot conclude exactly what's happened. You know, I've seen photos, and I don't know if it's true or not, of so-called white helmet groups without any protective equipment handling alleged Sarin victims. I mean, if that happens, the rescuers would find themselves imperiled as the people they're trying to rescue.
Right.
Because sarin is absorbed through the skin. So there's some tells here that have to be looked at, and it's much more difficult to be able to come to a conclusion based on pictures than it is to send a team of investigators to the site and gather information and tissue samples and really do the forensics. But because that hasn't been done, because it's been deliberately ignored, one has to wonder if we're being played here. One has to wonder if this is, in fact, a false flag. One has to wonder if the Trump administration is being manipulated into launching missile strikes against Syria based on these heartbreaking photos of dead children, and that we don't know what the facts are. But,
yeah.
But the response is that, well, you know, Assad has to go. Well, that sounds like an agenda when you don't have facts available.
Yeah, a long-standing agenda that's predated this incident. I wonder what you make of the attacks in the U.S. media and the U.S. Congress on people who talk the way we're talking on this program. I mean, isn't it, in a rational world, isn't it possible to oppose bombing Syria and not think that any of the parties involved in the war are saints and not be an advocate for some other side of a war?
There's not anyone in the picture who's eligible for canonization. But we have to remember that there are so many different groups and so many different agendas. You have Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Qatar, the United States and the UK have all been involved in various ways in supporting the effort to, covert and overt effort to oust the Assad government. What I find very interesting is that people raise questions. That people who challenge the illegal use of U.S. force against another country are being attacked. Let's talk about Representative Tulsi Gabbard, who, full disclosure, I joined her in a trip to Syria a few months ago on a fact-finding mission to determine actually what was happening on the ground and to meet with all sides and get opinions from everybody who's inside Syria in the various places we were at. So yesterday, Representative Gabbard met with full-throated criticism from former DNC chair and presidential candidate Howard Dean and also the head of the Center for American Progress. I think that one needs to ask some serious questions here. Why is Tulsi Gabbard being attacked? For simply asking questions, for raising the possibility that there's no proof of this attack. I mean, it's, you know, just saying it doesn't make it so. The fact that there's no scientific evidence of what happened is a problem. The fact that no one asked to go or demanded that we go to Syria to get the details. The fact that no one asked the Syrian government for entry to be able to get the physical evidence. That's a problem. And so Tulsi Gabbard raises these points, and she's attacked. by Howard Dean, by the Center for American Progress, almost an oxymoronic name at this point. And we have to ask what the motive is. What's really going on here?
Yeah.
Why are the people who are waging war illegally being celebrated, and those who raise questions and say, hey, wait a minute, what's really going on here, are being subject to harsh criticism?
I think all of us focused on Syria because of Donald Trump's actions could be accused of going along with a diversion of attention from numerous other wars, including Yemen, where millions are facing starvation as a result of a U.S.-Saudi war. On the other hand, Syria is somewhat special here in that there is an increased risk of a confrontation between the two big nuclear governments, is there not?
Well, President Medvedev of Russia has already made it clear that we're on a path towards conflict and potential combat. You know, Russians are not to be trifled with. You know, while the U.S. spends 10 times the amount on the military than the Russians do, Russians have a military base in Syria, Tartus, and they have an abiding interest in not letting Syria become a platform in the Middle East to attack Russian business activities in oil and gas. I'm not a spokesperson for that government or any government, but I have to say that the effort of the United States to dislodge Russia from that area is dangerous because we have military bases, 800 military bases around the country. We're in 130 different countries at least. And who are we to start telling other nations that they can't have any kind of a presence in another country if they're invited in? And so the showdown in Syria with Russia is a dangerous thing, as is the showdown with Iran and a potential showdown with China, which has been establishing ties with Syria. We could be at the threshold of a much wider war. All it takes is an incident, a miscalculation, some kind of an error, a misreading of a cue, and we could find ourselves in the middle of a Cuban Missile Crisis level of danger. This current administration doesn't really have the diplomatic talent available to tell us which way to go. The head of their U.N. representative is already rattling the saber. Secretary of State, who is supposed to have business ties with Russia, is making intemperate remarks. The president seems to be bandied about by powerful winds in Washington. We're in a dangerous situation. You've got a Congress that is weak, except for a few hawks who want not only to plus up the military budget, but want to use everything that it has.
Yeah. How much do you think this is the result, this shift in Trump's position and actions, is the result of all the Russian demonization madness that has been coming out of the permanent establishment and the Democratic Party?
You know, that's important. It's important that we discussed the demonization of Russia. And I think what the demonization of Russia does is it legitimates the further escalating tensions with Russia, and sets the stage for a showdown with Russia over what I've said this before. I'll say it again. Russia didn't tilt the election. Director Comey of the FBI did. Immeasurable effects in this key state from the revelation of new emails. Democrats don't want to talk about that because they'd rather rely on a fiction that somehow the Russians did it. And they don't want to go back to the fact that any mention of Secretary Clinton's emails raises further questions about her credibility. But in fact, there was nothing discovered that, at least that we know of, that should have resulted in criminal prosecution. and she was entitled to due process of law, did not receive it. She was smeared by the FBI on the eve of the election. That had a measurable effect on the election. The Democrats don't want to address that because they prefer to misdirect to the FBI, and the Republicans don't want to get into Comey's role because then that raises questions about the nature of their victory in November. So we're in a situation where the reality of the attacks on Russia have put us in a position where we are in a dialectic of conflict here, and it keeps escalating. It's very dangerous, and it's based once again on lies. You know, are there business connections with the Trump? Trump people, absolutely. But you know what? Here again, you need some evidence of direct manipulation in the election, and we haven't seen that. We've seen suppositions, we've seen charges, but no. You know, where's the evidence again?
Yeah, we've got just about 2 minutes left, Dennis Kucinich. What should people be doing if they overcome the Russian obsession? What should people be engaged in terms of pushing for alternative approaches to Syria and the world, and in terms of holding the U.S. government and Donald Trump accountable?
Well, Congress is out for the next couple of weeks, and we need to organize a public response. For anyone who's listening, part of that is to contact congressional offices and say, hey, back off. Don't drag us into a wider war. And, you know, investigate. Even at this late point, even after more bombings have occurred, investigate these claims. You know, the bodies of people, there has to be some bodies that are accessible. And for autopsy purposes, tissue samples could be taken. You know, there's something that could be done to at least try to find out exactly what happened. But the incuriousness of the Washington establishment is pretty predictive of another agenda and the fact that it's quite possible they're lying about this. So we have to press Congress. We have to demand action. We don't want to ask them to vote on a war resolution because right now, chances are, given the current state, who knows, maybe it could pass. We've got to, but the American people have to be activated here. And we have to read critically what's happening. Look, you know, I've had the experience through 16 years in Congress in being able to critically analyze claims that the government has made and finding out time after time after time they're lying.
Yeah.
And you know, unless, you know, and I've had to do this day in and day out to check these things out. The average citizen getting bombarded from social media and mainstream media with claims and counterclaims, it's very tough to figure out what's going on. But if you do, it takes some time to do your own research, you'll see that some things just don't make sense. It doesn't make sense that the Assad government, which was winning the war in Syria and turned the corner in Aleppo, would suddenly drop a gas attack on people in their own, you know, in their own country. And that's the same argument over and over and again that could be made about what's happened there. And the proof has not been brought forward in this incident in any satisfactory way, nor was it brought forward in the 2013 and 2011 attack. And there's always the possibility that these are false flags that are being done to drag the United States into a broader conflict. We have to demand Congress start asking serious questions, quit beating the drums of war.
Very, very good point, Dennis Kucinich. Thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersnap.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, corporate media often describe the country as being roiled by police brutality or as grappling with racism in the criminal justice system. But when elites get to define the problem, they get to decide what constitutes solving it. And for many people, that makes for too shallow a conversation when it comes to policing. We'll talk about the limits of police reform with Alex Vitale, Associate Professor of Sociology at Brooklyn College and author of City of Disorder, How the Quality of Life Campaign Transformed New York Politics, and of the forthcoming The End of Policing. That conversation is coming up, but first we'll take a look back at recent press. Corporate media reaction to Donald Trump's April 7th missile strike on a Syrian airfield might be summed up in an ironic tweet from FAIR analyst Adam Johnson. Find someone who looks at you the way U.S. media look at bombs. Daily papers lined up to endorse Trump's action. As of April 11th, out of the top 100 U.S. newspapers, 47 had run editorials, 37 in favor, 7 ambiguous, and only 1 opposed to the military attack. Sample headlines: Syria strike shows U.S. resolve, striking Syria long overdue, and Serious on Syria, the attack was a message to Russia and China, too. The public at the time was much more divided. An ABC Washington Post poll found 51% supporting the airstrikes and 40% opposed. The one anti-editorial from the Houston Chronicle opposed the attack on constitutional grounds. It lacked a legislative framework. Like every other paper, the Chronicle presented the Assad government's responsibility for the April 4th chemical attack on Khan Sheikhoun, the pretense for the strike, as a given, omitting qualifiers like alleged or accused. Immediately after the attack, as Americans were just forming their opinions, corporate media opinion was already established. Johnson looked at 5 top dailies: the New York Times, Washington Post, USA Today, Wall Street Journal, and New York Daily News, and found none offering any opinion space to anyone who thought the attack shouldn't have happened. The 5 papers ran a total of 18 op-eds, columns, or news analysis articles that either praised the strikes or criticized them for not being harsh enough. The New York Times ran a piece headed, "On Syria Attack, Trump's Heart Came First." The Washington Post called it Trump's chance to step into the global leadership vacuum. On television, we had MSNBC's Brian Williams opining weirdly about the beautiful pictures of fearsome armaments. And CNN's Fareed Zakaria embodied what FAIR's Jim Noricus called the essential pundit take that Donald Trump became president of the United States by aiming Tomahawk missiles at a sovereign state. As a candidate telling Obama he should not get involved in the Syrian civil war, explained Zakaria, Trump showed he was unconcerned with global norms. This attack on another country, unjustifiable in terms of self-defense and unauthorized by the UN, shows Trump's education. He's, quote, recognized that the president of the United States does have to act to enforce international norms, does have to have this broader moral and political purpose. President Trump realized, as every president has for many decades now, that presidents always believe they have inherent legal authority as commander-in-chief, and they don't need to go to a pesky Congress every time they want military force, close quote. Zakaria's open contempt for public opinion or legislative process, his strange idea that asserting that the U.S. need not comply with international law reflects international norms, evoke earlier generations of war punditry. Narikas recalled the New York Times' R.W. Appel, who declared of the elder President George Bush in 1989 that he had completed, quote, a presidential initiation rite, joining American leaders who since World War II have felt a need to demonstrate their willingness to shed blood to protect or advance what they construe as the national interest. Panama has shown him a man capable of bold action, close quote. Yes, Panama. The Washington Post was among the many who referred to the idea that with this airstrike, Trump was righting Obama's wrongs in Syria, picking up on what writer Reed Richardson called the dangerous Obama did nothing narrative. When folks like CNN anchor Jake Tapper ask, what will it take for the world to intervene in Syria? They're standing on its head a reality in which the U.S., Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Qatar, and Russia, for instance, have been intervening in Syria for years. The U.S. has been arming, funding, and training anti-Assad forces since at least 2012. The Post itself reported in 2015 that the CIA alone was spending $1 billion a year training Syrian rebels. After the oft-mentioned chemical weapons attack in Damascus in 2013, Obama negotiated a Syrian chemical weapons eradication program, Richardson notes, with Russian assistance. You can say that that didn't work, but you can't say that it didn't happen. One account in the Associated Press states flatly that after warning Syria that an attack would lead to U.S. action, quote, Obama failed to follow through. Rather than authorizing military action against Assad in response to a sarin gas attack that killed hundreds outside Damascus, Obama opted instead for a Russia-backed agreement to remove Syria's chemical weapons stockpiles. That was seen internationally as a major blow to U.S. credibility, and for Obama's critics, a prime example of weak leadership. Close quote. So just to underscore, AP is saying that non-military action is not action at all. To say such coverage is corrosive to democracy is an understatement. As Richardson concludes, if the press can't be trusted to honestly report what a previous president did or did not do in Syria, there's little hope for the press helping the public figure out what the current president should or shouldn't do there going forward. As we tape this show, we learn that the U.S. has dropped a massive ordnance air blast bomb, the largest non-nuclear bomb ever used in combat, on a supposed ISIS complex in Afghanistan. We'll see if corporate media think this is beautiful, too. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. A former Chicago police officer is accused of framing some 51 people for murders they didn't commit. BuzzFeed's Melissa Segura reports that police brass, prosecutors, judges, oversight commissions, and federal authorities all had ample opportunity to stop Reynaldo Guevara. Instead, they promoted him, built cases around him, and ignored even those swearing in open court to abuse. Tulsa police officer Betty Shelby explained why she killed an unarmed man walking away from her at a traffic stop. If I wait to find out if he had a gun or not, I could very well be dead, Shelby said. The public conversation has come some way toward acknowledging that even if not every officer does what Guevara or Shelby did, it's not appropriate to think of them as isolated bad apples, because their actions and attitudes are not just permitted, but in a sense produced by an institutional and social climate, by a system. But if such abuses are not so much mistakes in the system as indicators of fundamental problems, is reform really the right model for the change required? Or should our conversation move toward placing less emphasis on how policing is done and more on why? Alex Vitale is Associate Professor of Sociology at Brooklyn College and author of City of Disorder, How the Quality of Life Campaign Transformed New York Politics. His upcoming book, The End of Policing, will be out this summer from Verso. He joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Alex Vitale.
Thank you.
Well, op-ed pages and other spaces are reflecting concern right now that the call from Jeff Sessions for a review of consent decrees with some police departments means that the reforms that such measures have led to or could lead to are in jeopardy. The New York Times cites body cameras and reporting requirements. Others point to increased training, including in the use of force. The sense is that there are serious flaws in law enforcement, preeminently a breakdown in community relations, but we're fixing those flaws, though that progress is now under threat. What sorts of questions or concerns do you have with that understanding of things?
You know, I have two concerns about the kind of hand-wringing that's been occurring over the Trump pullback on police oversight. One is the idea that policing can only be reformed if the federal government is there as a backstop, when the reality is that policing is a local matter that is under the control of local mayors. And I think in particular of a case like Baltimore, where there was this sense in which, oh my God, if the feds pull out, we won't be able to reform our police, when it's the mayor and the city council who are saying that, and they have the statutory power to enact the changes that need to be enacted there. So the reality, though, the sort of the second point, is that the federal interventions have not been very successful. These kinds of procedurally focused interventions that ask police to change what's in their rule books, to implement some training, to possibly add some body cameras. These are what we often refer to as procedural justice changes that attempt to make policing adhere more closely to the law, engage in better communication with those subjected to law enforcement, but never interrogate in any meaningful way the basic mission that the police have been given. I often use the example of, you know, a perfectly legally executed and well-communicated marijuana arrest can still ruin a young person's life, can eliminate their ability to get work in the future, cut off financial aid, put a felony or even just a misdemeanor drug arrest on their record. And so that is a substantive justice issue that is rarely addressed with these kinds of procedural reform measures that we've seen come out of the feds under the Obama administration.
We read often about a breakdown in relationships between communities of color in particular and law enforcement, or we read about a loss of trust. And that implies an earlier halcyon day. History is, in fact, deeply meaningful, but not the kind of imaginary history that this invokes. Can you remind us of some of the origin story of policing in America, which gets at the why?
Yes, so I have a new essay in the New Inquiry called The Myth of Liberal Policing that is adapted from a chapter of the forthcoming book. And in it, I basically challenge this liberal notion that policing has always existed to fight crime and to keep us safe, when the historical record is really dramatically different, that the policing has always been a tool of state coercion that has served the interests of maintaining and reproducing existing economic arrangements of inequality. And in particular, I link it to three major institutional forces in the 18th and 19th century, and those are colonialism, the manage of the emerging industrial working class, and slavery. And on the latter part in particular, I went down to Charleston, South Carolina, and I looked at some of the origins of the Charleston City Guard, which predated the formation of the London Metropolitan Police that are often held up as like the first modern police force. Mm-hmm. And what I found was that the Charleston City Guard was a direct outgrowth of efforts to manage what was an emerging mobile industrial slave population. In cities like Charleston, Savannah, and New Orleans, slaves actually worked outside of the home of their owners in many cases. They worked on wharves, in warehouses, and in emerging industrial production. They carried little badges that identified their owner and their permission to move about freely, but they also, as a result of this, had access to some money and began to form underground societies and engage in underground leisure activities, drinking establishments, gambling, but also religious groups, study groups, people were learning how to read. And white residents of Charleston were terrified about this freely moving black population and basically created a police force to manage that mobile slave population. Mm-hmm. And of course, these forces then, after the Civil War, become transformed into the kind of Jim Crow police forces that we see, you know, using water hoses and dogs on civil rights protesters. So this idea that the police existed to produce crime-free, secure societies was only really true in the South for whites.
Right, and that piece, The Myth of Liberal Policing, is online at thenewinquiry.com. And it also, there are a lot of interesting aspects, including, you know, the militarization of police work we think of as something new, and that, in fact, or the adaptation of tools and tactics from war being brought home to domestic policing. That's not really new either, and there's also information on that history in there as well.
Let me just say something about, though, because it's important to understand police as an alternative to using the military, mm-hmm. because before the emergence of modern police forces in the early to mid-19th century, state authorities had to rely on local militias or the army to put down riots, insurrections, strikes, etc. And those forces had very limited tools to use, basically sabers and muskets. And as a result, they killed a lot of people. And that process served to undermine state legitimacy. Mm-hmm. And civilian police forces are created to manage those problems in a less violent, less militarized way, primarily because of the desire to improve legitimacy. And Robert Peel, who creates the first London police force, he learned this while being in charge of the English occupation of Ireland, where he creates the first civilian peace force that replaces militias with a more permanent and less militarized force that focuses on preemptive political action, embedding themselves in local communities, making arrests, instead of lining up and shooting people.
But with a goal, and this continues, this lineage draws down to today, with an ultimate goal of shoring up legitimacy. And I guess what we're talking about is it's that very legitimacy that seems to go unchallenged, the legitimacy of the role of law enforcement within society.
That's right. So this idea of legitimacy goes unchallenged in contemporary debates. Everyone just assumes, yes, police legitimacy is a good thing. And my point is that we actually need to really question what the purpose of police legitimacy is. If it is to manufacture public consent for a war on drugs, a war on terror, a war on disorder, then it's deeply problematic. It is basically enabling these coercive state forces to maintain and reinforce racial and economic inequality.
Well, one of the places that those contradictions have become most pointed recently is when people are saying that they want to support the idea of sanctuary cities where local officials wouldn't cooperate with ICE and deportations, but at the same time, they don't recognize that they need to also challenge broken windows policies. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that nexus and why it's important to see.
Yes, my colleague Alan Aha and I wrote a piece for a local newspaper here in New York in which we laid this out not long after the election, where we said Trump claims that he intends to ramp up the deportation of immigrants with any kind of criminal record, meant that hundreds of thousands potentially of people across New York would be at risk of ending up in deportation proceedings, not because they were violent criminals, but because they had jumped the turnstile on the way to work or had gotten arrested for riding their bike on the sidewalk. And while the city may claim that they don't actively cooperate with federal authorities, all federal authorities have to do is just plant themselves in court. And as people appear on these charges, they can literally just pick them up and take them away for deportation proceedings. Now, we haven't seen this kind of widespread practice for low-level offenses so far, but we have seen some instances of this. And certainly, as the Trump administration, you know, ramps up its rhetoric and its enforcement, this is a real risk. And it could include not just people here without any documentation, but even those on certain kinds of visas or green cards, conceivably, as the criminalization of this population rolls along.
Well, and I guess also one of the things you hope folks will see is that, yes, now you're paying attention to how easily people can be caught up in the system, and we should care about that even if the outcome is not deportation, but just, you know, as you said earlier, a ruined life, that kind of low-level criminalization, very selectively enforced, is damaging, and we should understand that it's damaging, even as we trace it, you know, damaging new communities or people in new ways. Well, I think that when some people do support the idea of less policing, you know, as opposed to better policing, I think they do so to some extent as part of a utopia, you know, that they don't see a morning, you know. It's a feeling that that's a long way off, and in the meantime, it seems to imply chaos. You know, what do you possibly mean having less police? I wonder if you can talk a little bit about just how you introduce the idea to people.
So my approach has been to directly and empirically interrogate specific aspects of policing, mostly things that have come under police control only in the last 40 years, and to ask, what are the origins of this kind of policing? What are the consequences of this kind of policing? And what are the alternatives to this kind of policing? So one example I often start with is school policing. Here in New York City, we now have more NYPD personnel in city schools than we have counselors of all varieties, over 5,000 personnel. And the origin of school policing is based in many ways on two myths. One is the super predator myth that was perpetuated by conservative academics and politicians in the 1990s that said that we were on the brink of a wave of pathological youth violence that was going to run amok in our cities and schools, and that we needed to identify, isolate, and neutralize this threat. Of course, every year after that article and those views were put forward, youth crime dropped. But nonetheless, it became fodder for a movement to put armed police in our schools. The other was the myth that following Columbine, that our schools were incredibly dangerous places and the only way to keep them safe was to place armed police there. Of course, what people forget is that there were already armed police at Columbine when that tragic shooting happened, and they were totally unable to prevent the attack. And in fact, that year and in the years following, school is the safest place that young people spend time. It's safer than their homes. It's safer than their communities. So there are problems in schools. There are problems with discipline and even problems with crime and violence. But there's absolutely no evidence that putting armed police in schools is fixing that problem. In fact, the research shows just the opposite. Instead, we need to look at things like restorative justice programs, rethinking disciplinary measures, and also looking at the corrosive role of high-stakes testing in driving both students away from a positive attitude about education and orienting schools towards driving those young people out of those institutions through suspensions and criminalization. So that's an example where we don't need nicer school police, we don't need better trained school police, we don't need school police to be mentors to young people, we need to eliminate school policing altogether.
Well, let me just ask you finally, and it's and you're illustrating it, but the idea of depolicing is not in contrast necessarily to the idea of reform. What would you say the relationship is? I mean, how do they fit together?
So I think that obviously there are needs for major changes in policing. The problem is this misunderstanding that if we change some training, we hire a few more diverse police officers, we put on body cameras, that this will accomplish anything substantial. If we don't change the fundamental mission of police, those reforms will not work. So efforts to reform the police don't have to all be about eliminating these police functions, but they can't either be only focused on a handful of procedural reforms. I look for reforms that bring immediate relief or, you know, more or less, but that point towards larger structural changes. So eliminating broken windows policing will bring relief right away to people, but it also questions why we rely on police to manage homeless people urinating in public, why we use police to manage young people in the summer hanging out in the park after it closes, and why we manage poor people having to jump the turnstile because they can't afford the ever-increasing subway fare. In addition to those police reforms, we need to address those underlying dynamics that are producing the crime and disorder that we have asked the police to fix for us.
Alex Vitale is Associate Professor of Sociology at Brooklyn College. His forthcoming book, The End of Policing, will be out this summer from Verso. Alex Vitale, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
You're most welcome.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
At some point, our climate will change so much, it will be a whole new system, different from anything known in human history. But when? There's a paper for that. In 2013, a team of 14 scientists from the University of Hawaii published their work titled The Projected Timing of Climate Departure from Recent Variability. That was in the journal Nature. To learn more, we've reached the lead author, Dr. Camilo Mora. He's with the Department of Geography at the University of Hawaii and heads the Mora Lab. From Honolulu, Camilo Mora, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Pleasure to be here.
Is it fair to say your paper asks when Earth will shift to a new climate?
Yes, that's the ultimate question that we wanted to answer with that specific paper. We know that climate change is happening, but unfortunately people don't really have a good sense of the timeline of when this is going to happen. Is this going to happen in 100, 1,000, 2,000 years? So on this specific paper, we were asking that question, when is climate change going to happen?
Okay, now the weather is always changing and the climate even has its rhythm. So what did your team use as a baseline for what we might call normal, or at least relatively normal?
That's right. So the word change means that something that we are used to is changing, right? So one of the things that we did for this specific paper was to quantify that what is the things that we are used to. So for that, we used the temperatures for the last 200 years, and we look at all of the climatic variability of those 200 years. So that's pretty much the climate variability that we are used to. Then we took our climate models to project the time after which temperature exceeds any record that we had in history. And that's done for every pixel globally. So for every global pixel, we know exactly the time when these climatic models project that the temperature is going to be like something that we had never seen before.
So that's what you define as climate departure.
That's right. It's basically when the climate of a specific place moves beyond what the place is used to.
Well, let's not keep the kids in suspense. Suppose we manage to control our greenhouse gas emissions. By the year 2100, we go to only 538 parts per million CO2, and that's the 4.5 pathway developed by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So if we act on climate and follow that 4.5 pathway, when does the global near-surface air temperature cross the point of climate departure?
Well, that's one of the things that we found more remarkable about this one paper, is that the climatic changes that we are doing on our planet are so dramatic and so huge that even if we take action on climate change, the climate is still going to change. You know, and the way that we put this is like imagine that you are in a highway and you are 100 miles per hour, full speed, and somehow you realize, oh, that, okay, this is too dangerous for me to drive at this speed. You can put your feet on the brake. And there is just no way that car is going to stop right away. That car, given the speed that comes with, has a momentum, meaning that it's going to keep moving forward until it finally comes to a resting point. That's exactly what's happening to the climate as well. So even if we stop climate change right now, our models projected that climate departure is still going to happen. In fact, the saddest thing of that paper was the fact that under business as usual, the whole temperature of our planet, all of the temperature of our planet will move to a new state by 2040s, in that decade of the 2040s to the 2050s. If we take action on climate change, that timing is delayed by some 20 years. So this is not to say that we shouldn't do anything, but we should just maybe start thinking ahead to prevent those consequences that will come from those massive changes in our climate.
Well, by my reading of your paper, and please correct me if I'm wrong, it looks like there is about a 14-year margin of possible error or change in your figure for that RCP 8.5, the worst pathway that we could take. And that would bring us a new climate as early as 2033 or just 16 years from now. Do I have that wrong?
No, you don't have that wrong. And in fact, there was a lot of controversy on these papers from the scientific perspective, given that uncertainty. And the whole analysis was repeated. And what we ended up finding out was that once you control for much precise uncertainty, that number is actually sooner, you know. So that's one thing. The other thing that happened with this paper is that it created a lot of controversy, and a lot of people just emailed me and phone called me to say all kind of nasty stuff. But there was a lot of other people that also emailed me saying, no, you are wrong, because this is not going to happen in 20 years' time. This is already happening. And for instance, one of the phone calls this lady actually called me that I remember the most is this lady from the Niagara Falls. She said to me, look, I think that you are wrong. The reason why I think so is because those changes that you are prognosticating are already happening. When I was a child, I was used to walk across the Niagara River. That river was a time that was frozen, and today there is just no way. I mean, you will drown if you dare to even get closer to that river these days. So those changes are already happening. Anyway, yeah, so going back to your original question, there was an uncertainty on these projections because we were using all of the models that were available, so there is always going to be that error, but that error actually was very conservative according to our estimations.
Well, we've been talking about near-surface air temperatures, the kind humans have measured for about 150 years where we live. But what about the global average sea surface temperatures? Does that hit a new state at the same time as the air or at different times?
No, that's later. Obviously, the water has more inertia. You know, you cannot heat up the water at the same speed that you heat up the air. So that is a variable that we usually have climate change happening later. The opposite is climatic changes that are easier to change, like, for instance, the ocean's pH. The ocean's pH has been stable for millions of years, and so because there is not so much variability, it's very easy for these small additions of greenhouse gases to move the pH of the oceans to a new state. So according to our paper, pH is one climatic variable that we already exceeded the variability of that one variable in the last 200 years. So we have different variables that will respond differently to this. So on one end, we have climatic change variables that had already happened, and some other climatic variables that will be lay in the century to change.
Well, Camila, we've been talking carefully about global average temperatures, and nature is never that neat. We know the progress and impacts of climate change are not evenly distributed. Where does a new climate arrive first?
So there are two important questions that you point out there, two related questions. One is the fact that we have been looking at the means, and actually these days after that paper, we have focused more on the variability, because actually what we are thinking right now is that it's the variability, the one that is the most dangerous. We are talking about things like heat waves, storms, hurricanes. Those are things that have very strong pulse effects, as opposed to things that are slower over time. So both of those things, the mean and the streams, are changing. Now, the other way in which you can formulate this question is, where is this variability going to happen the soonest? And what we discover, as opposed to what has been known, is that this climate departure is going to be happening earlier in the tropics. When you look at what is known about climate change, we always thought that the largest climatic changes are going to happen at the poles. That is correct. But unfortunately, the poles are used to a lot of climatic variability, so it's very difficult for climate change to move beyond what the variability is on that place, right? So the climatic changes that we are imposing on that system are equal or smaller or a little bit larger than the climatic variability on those places. The opposite happens in the tropics. The tropics are very stable, so very small changes in the climate will move the climate of the tropics to a new state. And that turns out to be a super dangerous conditions for the tropics, because by the same token, all of the species that are there, they are not used to any change at all. So as soon as you change the conditions on the tropics for a little bit, that will have massive ramifications for ecosystems. A good example of that are the coral reefs. Coral reefs these days, when you heat up the water just by just 1 or 2 degrees Celsius, during El Nino events, all of those corals struggle. Many of them bleach, and hundreds of them just die. So now imagine what it will happen if you heat up the water of the tropics by 2 degrees Celsius. You completely exceed the levels of tolerance of many of these species there.
Now, according to the maps in the appendix of this paper, the point of climate departure comes a little bit later in Peru and a couple of decades later in Australia. And that just as you talked about, seems odd to me from our experience, because Australia seems to be at the front lines of climate change. They have record heat, they have massive land fires, droughts, flooding, and the corals dying. How can all these signs appear now if Australia is behind the rest of the world in climate departure time?
Yeah, so they are different. Again, that's kind of one of the ramifications. That's one of the things that we are studying right now. Unfortunately, the climate is a very complex interaction of climatic variables. So commonly, we look at just temperature, right? And temperature might influence certain countries, but not others. Unfortunately, as you just point out, the climate is related to other things like floods, sea level rise, hurricanes, and things like that. So basically, what the field is calling for is a more comprehensive assessment of these climatic changes altogether. And that's some of the things that we are working on right now.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Camilo Mora from the University of Hawaii. We're talking about the time when we depart to a new climate. Camilo, it's strange, but humans seem more worried about when the climate will be different than what it will be like to live then. Your paper did address that, at least by referencing other relevant science. What are some of the ways a changed climate could impact humans?
I mean, that question is massive. I mean, I just don't know why people don't get it. You know, like, I mean, climate is such an important thing to the livelihoods of people that it's just mind-blowing to me that we are tampering with that stuff. You know, and let me just give you some examples. Heat waves. Heat waves in 2003, there was a heat wave in Europe that killed over 50,000 people. Over 60,000 people died in 2 weeks. So this is like the September 11 attack every day for 2 straight weeks, just to give you a comparison of how bad the heat wave was. A similar heat wave happened 3 years later in Europe. There was one in 2010 in Russia. There was one in Chicago in 1995. And these heat waves are popping up all around the world, killing people like nobody's business. Australia is a case example where that happens quite a lot. Then you had hurricanes. The research, the knowledge is now increasing to suggest that the intensity of these hurricanes is associated with this warming already. And those massive storms that we are seeing in the Caribbean and also in the South Pacific are some examples of that. Then we had drought in California, Africa, for God's sake. People are starving to death, and the whole ecosystem is incapable of producing the food that these people need. I mean, and I can just keep going on this. You know, there is an entire book over a few thousand pages long called the IPCC Report, where they documented all of these climatic changes and how they influence humanity. So it's just mind-blowing that we as a species haven't been able to comprehend how bad this is for us to tamper with that.
And as you said, your paper found the climate shift first in the poorest countries and nearer the equator. To me, that suggests two things, unfortunately, in mass deaths due to the return of famine and disease, and mass emigration as people move towards a more survivable climate. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, absolutely. That's another project that I wish we had more resources to do this, which is another thing, by the way. We got attacked because people say that we're doing this for the money. I just don't know where the people make those claims, because I would like to invite these people to come to my lab to realize that we are doing this out of just pure curiosity for knowledge, for this kind of stuff. But what you just say is totally true. If you look at where these climatic changes are happening, they're happening in the poorest countries in the world. That means a couple things. One is that action for climate change is going to be delayed because nobody cares about what's happening in those countries. You can see that, for instance, in scenarios like what is happening today in Syria. It's a total chaos, but nobody, no developed country wants to put their hands on that country. And that's, imagine now what it will be for climate change when people is starving to death. My guess is that there is not going to be action being taken on this until these conditions start influencing the developed countries. And unfortunately, I think that that's going to be a delayed process. So by that time, it's probably going to be super late for us to fix this problem. But that's not to say, though, that the consequences won't be felt on developed countries, because my guess is that there's going to be a massive increase in immigration. So today we are very concerned about people migrating from Mexico to the United States. Just wait. Wait until the United States, until Mexico loses the land in Mexico loses the capability to produce agriculture, which is the major sector of job employment in that country. Now imagine what it will be when all of those Mexicans become unemployed and they had the United States just across the border offering all of these capabilities to improve their quality of life. My guess is that all of the people will try to cross there. You will have the same thing in Europe. Africa completely devastated by climate change. Guess what? All of those people from Africa is most likely going to continue migrating to Europe. The same thing happens in Australia. All of these people in Indonesia most likely are going to be moving there. So, again, for me as a scientist, it's just sad that as a scientist, we haven't managed to convince the general public of how bad this is. Unfortunately, we are not there yet, but once we are there, it's going to be too late for us to take some actions on this.
And, of course, we're just talking about humans picturing themselves. What happens to the land animals and plants when they encounter a different climate? And is that something that you study in your lab?
Yes, so that's something that we are studying in our lab. Unfortunately, if we don't care about what happens to the humans, of course, as a species, we are going to care much less about what happens to the species. And unfortunately, the species don't have an air conditioning for them to take rest whenever there is a heat wave. So unfortunately, those species are going to be the ones that will suffer the most. So the predictions that are coming out about the impacts of climate change on species are just devastating. I haven't done the work myself, but there are a few other papers documenting this, like 50% of the birds, just to give you an example, could potentially lose the land where they live today because the climatic conditions where they are will become unsuitable from the climatic perspective for them to be in there. So those species will be forced to migrate. Unfortunately, many of these species are located on islands. So all of those species on islands are pretty much, that's it. I mean, there's just no chance for those species. They have no chance to migrate. And unfortunately, these climatic changes are happening way too fast for them to generate the necessary adaptations to cope with climate change. So, yeah, I mean, the picture for species don't look so good.
And then there's all the small creatures that are right at the base of the food chain that we depend on, the bacteria. I've interviewed several scientists about the impact of warming seas on plankton, and that's the basis of the food chain there and the source of half the oxygen we breathe. Do you worry about things like plankton and bacteria and how they're going to change along with this climate?
Yeah, I mean, that's not really my line of research. However, one thing that we studied was the effect of oxygen depletions in the oceans. And we encountered on all of these simulations, I mean, this is already happening, and the models actually agree with that to some degree, the fact that the oceans are reducing the amount of oxygen. So this is happening for a couple of reasons. One is the fact that the patterns of oceans, the air circulation are changing. So the oxygen exchange is being changed, but more dramatically is the fact that there is a lot of decomposition in the bottom of the oceans, and unfortunately that's creating these massive areas of the world where there is just no oxygen for the animals to survive there. So it's creating these anoxic conditions, pretty much whole areas of the oceans where the only things that can survive there are bacteria, and there's very few species that can survive under very low levels of oxygen.
So I have a couple of minor questions. First of all, what do you mean by sensible heat flux?
So when the energy comes from the sun, it can be divided into a couple, it can be partitioned into a couple processes. One is sensible heat and the other one is latent heat. So latent heat is when the heat gets converted, usually through the process of water evaporation. And sensible heat is just the energy that is trapped there, retained there. So imagine this like as you are putting water boiling, right? So you put the hand on the side of that boiler, the heat that you feel, that radiation, could be seen as a sensible heat, and the heat that is on top, the one that is evaporating, that will be called latent heat. And it turns out that that had a huge implications for how different places on the planet will heat up. Because places that are very dry, those places don't have water to evaporate, so most of the energy that comes from the sun remains there as a sensible heat, and that's a heat that you just don't want. Usually that's what the ones that create these massive spikes in temperature during heat waves. While places that had a lot of humidity had a lot of latent heat, mostly in tropical forests and things like that, so all of the energy that comes there, that's the reason why they are cool, because the energy that comes gets evaporated and dissipated through latent heat. Unfortunately, those are kind of scientific terms that are complicated for scientists to explain to the general public.
I think I get it. And you do show a map showing precipitation changes, but that doesn't show a lot of change this century except towards the poles. And given the droughts and the flooding elsewhere, that surprises me. Can you talk to us about that?
Yes. So again, that's just the result of looking at the mean as opposed to the extremes. One climatic variable that is complicated is temperature. And in fact, on the paper somewhere, we make a caution about the fact that climatic variables that had a lot of variability, like, for instance, precipitation, is very hard for our approach to be applied to. Our approach is to see the time in which the climatic signal exceeds climatic variability. So if the climatic variability is very big, then the signal will be very hard to see. Even if the signal is there, it's very hard for you to separate the variability that is caused by humans from the normal variability that happens on that climatic variable. So our index, well, was very good for things like temperature, was not so great for things like precipitation. So our paper was not able to pick up the signal of climate change on precipitation. But there are ways in which this signal has been able to be identified on precipitation.
All right. Now, it sounds a bit harsh, but even if we do act quickly to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, this paper shows only a 20 to 30 year difference in the arrival of a new climate regime. So why bother if it's going to happen anyway?
Well, because the conditions, the things that we'll be exposed to will be twice as worse, you know. So either you hit a wall at 20 miles per hour or you hit a wall at 100 miles per hour. And that's the difference that we have to make when it comes to where we want to take action on climate change or not. I mean, humanity cannot expect that we have done this damage to our planet. We have destroyed over 80% of the surface of our planet. We have completely transformed it. We cannot expect that we are not going to pay consequences for it. The question is, what is the magnitude of those consequences? We continue damaging the planet, then we are going to pay more consequences for it. We are like a spoiled kid, if you ask me, you know, expecting that we are going to do all of this damage and things are going to be just fine. So that's kind of the message that we try to make from that paper, is that, yes, we are going to pay the consequences for this, but it will be twice as hard if we don't take action on climate change pretty soon.
Well, I guess another thing is, if we can delay the time of climate departure by a couple of decades, maybe that would give us time for carbon removal and storage. Do you think geoengineering will be necessary?
Well, yes, I agree with that. But the thing is that I don't know why humanity also wants to look into such a complicated strategy when we already had something that God put on this planet for us to fix this problem. Trees today are one of the main mechanisms, the only biological mechanism that we know that can sequester that carbon. Here in Hawaii now, we have over 80% of the land completely transformed as well. What we are doing here is trying to restore those ecosystems, for those ecosystems to sequester the carbon that we are producing. And it's possible. People say that it's impossible. It turns out that today, if you want to sequester the CO2 that you produce, the average American will need to plant an average of 20 trees per year. So how crazy is that? So we decided to go and look with school children from here, and we start planting those trees, and it's not difficult at all. In a couple days, a couple weekends, you go and you will take care of those 20 trees. And that's all what you have to do on a yearly basis. And all of the investment that we are doing, developing that technology, we can invest it on that kind of project, and we'll not only fix climate change, but we actually will do something that we can all feel proud about.
Well, let's say we got back to 350 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere, as Bill McKibben wants. It's hard to picture what that new climate with the brakes on would even look like. I mean, would the poles begin to refreeze? Has anybody, Camilo, been able to study what happens if we actually reduce CO2?
No, that's a question that seems so unlikely that I guess that's the reason why many people don't even study it. But curiously enough, we are actually doing some experiments today, seeing what will happen under those, should we achieve those conditions, how the planet will look like, especially from the species perspective. But the true answer to that question is that I just don't know. And I haven't come across many papers that have explored that possibility, just because the reality is so far off that it's hard for us to even think that we will go back to the historical conditions that we were used to.
Well, another reality that's hard to picture is the one that the IPCC says we're headed on right now, the RCP 8.5 path. It's 936 parts per million by 2100. That's almost, well, it's more than triple the pre-industrial levels. And I wonder if that's even survivable. Could we survive in a world that's 5 to 6 degrees C hotter?
Oh, no, there is no way. And actually, we had a paper right now. This paper is going to be published. I'm hoping that it will be published in the next month or two. It has gone through peer review, and we took all kind of empirical data. This is no model data at all. This is actual cases when people die during heat waves to document the conditions under which people die. And the conditions are amazingly not that far off of the conditions that you see there today, which is the reason why people die in the first place, you know, because these very small climatic conditions exceed what people is capable of tolerating. So when you are talking about warming up the planet by 2 or 3 degrees Celsius, that's way beyond the conditions in which people have died in the past. And these conditions are going to be the norm in pretty much all of the tropical places, all the way up to maybe 30 or 40 degrees of latitude. So all of these tropics for humans will be unlivable outside. Obviously, my guess is that these people will adapt to it. We will buy air conditioning. Maybe we switch from working during the day to work at night and take longer siestas. We will adapt to it. I'm sure of that. But the climatic conditions outdoors are going to be like climatic conditions that today are capable of killing human beings. And this is how serious this is, and why we get, at least I get so passionate about it, is because the only problem that we had is for us to communicate this knowledge better to people, because the knowledge is as solid as it can be.
You know, my sense of this paper is that it might take another decade to get even more research to be complete. We need a similar projection of the deeper ocean water and the stratosphere, maybe even into land storage and release of heat. What sorts of things do you think still need to be done?
So, I mean, obviously, we want, as a scientist, we want to justify our work, and we want to continue working this, and we're going to be tweaking these things to just like the first fund, you know. If you look at the principle of the first lamp phone, it's pretty much the same functionality of a high-end iPhone today. You can just talk to a person through a line. But obviously, there have been massive improvements on how you do that. So climate science is I feel like it's on the same pathway. So we can get the principles of it, but we can potentially fine-tune much better those climatic models. And maybe we will never fine-tune those things. You know, for iPhones, as an example, keep improving all the time. The question is, do we wait until we get 100% certainty, or do we start acting right now? From my perspective as a scientist, I would think that we should do both. The science today is pretty good to suggest that we need to take a precautionary approach to this. I mean, the consequences of us being right will be just devastating for our planet.
We've been talking about the science of the coming new climate. The paper, The Projected Timing of Climate Departure from Recent Variability, was published in the journal Nature. You can find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Our guest is the lead author, Dr. Camilo Mora, from the University of Hawaii in Honolulu. Camilo, thank you so much for sharing your time and your insight with us.
My pleasure, Alex. Thank you very much for your interest.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
You just heard Camilo Mora warn that extreme heat already kills more than terrorist attacks and will become very widely spread in the coming hotter climate. His team have a paper in review about that. I'm chasing another guest who has written related papers on the reality of heat making the world more uninhabitable for humans, mammals, and even most plants. In the journal Science in 2008, Dr. Matthew Huber wrote a technical piece which should be on the front pages of newspapers and news sites. The article discusses the problems in the limited tools to assess how hot it was in the great warming extinction called the PETM, the Paleo-Eocene thermal maximum, 56 million years ago. Without going into details, the methods analyzing the minerals and isotopes in specific seashells may have fostered a mistake. Scientists were puzzled how sea surface temperatures could show so low in these tests, even when the land air temperatures were killing hot. The idea was formulated and pretty widely accepted that some kind of thermostat regulated the gross amount of heat that could accumulate in the tropics. Matthew Huber says there is no thermostat. The tropics got so hot that a lot of plant life died off. The plants were so busy fighting off the heat, they didn't get enough photosynthesis to survive. That great die-off of tropical plants released yet another burst of carbon into the air. Global temperatures soared at least 5 degrees C, or 9 degrees Fahrenheit, for at least 200,000 years. We're talking about utter disaster. that has already happened on Earth due to extreme climate change. Our guest Camila Mora says a 5 degrees C rise in global temperature is possible this time around, but not really survivable for us. Then in 2010, Huber came out with another blockbuster in PNAS titled An Adaptability Limit to Climate Change Due to Heat Stress. We have no time to cover that now, but let me read a few lines from the summary. Any exceedance of 35 degrees C for extended periods should induce hypothermia in humans and other mammals, as dissipation of metabolic heat becomes impossible. While this never happens now, it would begin to occur with global mean warming of about 7 degrees C, calling the habitability of some regions into question. With 11 to 12 degrees C warming, such regions would spread to encompass the majority of the human population as currently distributed. Eventual warmings of 12 degrees C are possible from fossil fuel burning. One implication is that the recent estimates of costs of unmitigated climate change are too low unless the range of possible warming can somehow be narrowed. End quote. I'm going to keep in correspondence with Matthew Huber in the hope that we can get him to explain. We all need to know.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Remember the nuclear power renaissance? It just died. Westinghouse Electric, the maker of a new design that was supposed to lead the future, has filed for bankruptcy. The multi-billion dollar cost overruns for nuclear plants now under construction in Georgia and South Carolina may probably be paid by the taxpayers again. Is it finally the end of this dangerous scam? Joining us now is Tim Judson, the executive director of the Nuclear Information Resource Service right near Washington, D.C. Tim, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. I appreciate you having me.
Okay, Westinghouse Electric. It's a household name and a legend in establishing the grid. Now it's going under. Who owns it?
Toshiba actually bought Westinghouse about 10 or 11 years ago. So, you know, while Westinghouse has always been thought of as an American brand and, you know, a lot of their nuclear operations are still headquartered here in the U.S., you know, they're actually owned by a Japanese corporation at this point.
The people promoting nuclear power, including Dr. James Hansen, always say, just wait for the new Westinghouse AP1000 reactors. They will be much safer. What did the company claim was better about this design?
Well, they claimed that there were a number of advantages both to safety and to economics of these plants. And in terms of safety, they were developing a design that incorporated improvements in safety regulations that happened, you know, in the 1980s after the Three Mile Island and Chernobyl accidents that, you know, involved shifting from a reliance on safety systems that involved a lot of, you know, active mechanics, you know, like pumps and electrical systems, to having some more passive systems that could run when there was no power to the reactor, like a gravity-fed emergency coolant system and that sort of thing. But what we saw happen, among the things that we saw happen, were that after the Fukushima accident started in 2011, that, you know, again, you know, the regulators had to go back and revise their safety standards. And so there were some additional changes that needed to be made to the designs. And, you know, nuclear safety is always a moving target because for some reason, the accidents that continue to happen end up superseding what the industry thought was, you know, was adequate safety standards before.
It's always like planning for the last war, and then we get new surprises. So where are these new Westinghouse reactors being built?
So there are four being built in China, and there are four being built in the U.S. You know, there's eight under construction. They're all behind schedule and over budget. The Chinese reactors are, they're believed to be finished and coming online later this year and next year. But the ones in Georgia and South Carolina are all at least 3 to 4 years behind schedule now, and more delays could be coming. The first of those reactors in Georgia and South Carolina were supposed to come online in 2016 originally, having been ordered in 2008. And now the first of those reactors isn't likely to come online, even if their revised schedules are held to, until late 2019. And it's quite possible that that some of those reactors could still end up being canceled and their schedules pushed back until the 2020.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, with this bankruptcy, can we be certain the reactors already begun in the U.S. Southeast will be completed and become operational?
There's no guarantee at all of it. In fact, in the last week, both regulators in both Georgia and South Carolina have for the first time indicated that some of these reactors may not actually be completed. The Westinghouse bankruptcy has thrown the entire completion of those projects into question because, you know, one of the things that's driven Westinghouse into bankruptcy is that the cost overruns and the schedule delays in building these reactors have had to be partly borne by Westinghouse. And while Westinghouse has said that it's committed to finishing the projects that it started, there's no guarantee that, in fact, they're going to be able to absorb additional costs that are likely to come up in trying to get that job done.
Toshiba is a gigantic Japanese electronics company. Tim, why don't they bail out their own nuclear subsidiary?
Well, there's a question of the amount of debt that Westinghouse has gotten into and whether Toshiba could adequately absorb that. You know, Westinghouse has built up about $6 billion in debts through trying to build these reactors, and it might just be too big of an egg for Toshiba to swallow. So what started out as Westinghouse declaring bankruptcy last year has now potentially expanded into Toshiba potentially declaring bankruptcy as the parent corporation now, just a month later. And there are some serious questions about whether the Japanese government is going to have to, you know, is going to intercede in the same way that the U.S. government interceded in bailing out the auto companies 8 years ago. But that may be the same sort of a thing happening with Toshiba.
Bloomberg reported just recently that Trump officials see a new national security issue in this Toshiba Westinghouse bankruptcy. The failure is so big and so dangerous that it's involved hurried meetings with Energy Secretary Rick Perry, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, and Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross. It sounds like an all-hands-on-deck emergency for the White House. Why are they concerned?
Well, I would leave it to the national security establishment to figure out whether there are real national security implications to Westinghouse going bankrupt. I think what they're most concerned about is whether China is going to step in and try to buy Westinghouse to essentially support its own nuclear ventures and the completion of its own reactors. But if there's national security information that the Westinghouse possesses, then they might be able to block China from acquiring the company. Although there's already been a ton of technology transfer from the U.S. to China for these nuclear power projects that's already taken place. And China's already developed its own new reactor designs based on essentially copycatting the Westinghouse reactors. So, you know, if there are real national security implications to information that Westinghouse might have about nuclear science or technology, then they should just stop that acquisition from taking place if it comes up and let Westinghouse just go bankrupt and die.
Wow. Well, suppose the American government doesn't end up paying for the mistakes of this private corporation and to finish these reactors. Who will eat all the cost overruns or the money spent on reactors that might never even open?
Well, that's a little bit to be decided. One of the factors that's in play is a financing provision that was created in the 2005 energy law, whereby the U.S. government offered up to $18 billion in taxpayer-guaranteed loans for the construction of these reactors. The two reactors that are being built in Georgia have received about $8.3 billion in this taxpayer financing, essentially what's called a loan guarantee that would allow, if the venture goes bankrupt or the company that owns the reactors isn't able to pay the loans, then essentially taxpayers would absorb that loss. Essentially, the loan would be forgiven, and taxpayers would have coughed up $8 billion without getting it repaid. The project in South Carolina actually didn't take advantage of that financing, so there's no taxpayer loans from the U.S. federal government in place. But in both states, what's really making both of these projects happen are state legislation that called construction work in progress. And anybody who – you should watch out for these kind of provisions in your own states, because what they essentially do is authorize the utilities to bill customers for power plants that are being built but aren't operational. And so, in effect, something like up to 20% of the electricity bills that people in South Carolina are paying right now are for construction costs of these two reactors that are still only about 30% complete. You know, there's billions of dollars more to be spent on these things. And the same thing is happening in Georgia.
And that's just the tip of the iceberg. You wrote something called Too Big to Bail Out: The Economic Costs of a National Nuclear Power Subsidy. Tim Judson, tell us about some of the ways the public is paying big private corporations these hidden subsidies for nuclear energy.
Sure. Well, the nuclear power companies have been going around the country the last couple of years talking about how there's an unlevel playing field where natural gas prices are cheap because of fracking, and renewable energy is unfairly subsidized so that people can sell wind and solar for cheaper than what nuclear plants can pay. The reality is, you know, that this is a really self-serving argument. Nuclear power has been one of the most heavily subsidized industries in the country for decades. And the current nuclear power plants were built with massive subsidies from federal and state governments. And they also include things that are sort of non-subsidy subsidies, like, for instance, the fact that nuclear power companies don't need to obtain private insurance to cover the cost of a nuclear meltdown, like happened at Three Mile Island or Fukushima. Essentially, the taxpayers are insuring those nuclear plants against accidents by essentially limiting the industry's liability, and taxpayers could end up paying for hundreds of billions of dollars in the case of a nuclear accident. Taxpayers are also ultimately going to be responsible for managing the nuclear waste that nuclear power plants generate for, you know, that's toxic for hundreds of thousands of years. And there's also, you know, other major costs like the cleanup of uranium mining sites where, you know, we have very lax environmental laws regulating uranium mining, and we have 15,000 abandoned uranium mine sites across the country that have never been cleaned up, and there's no provision yet for that to happen. And most of those uranium mines are in Native American communities, so there's a major environmental justice issues all around in this. These are all ways in which current nuclear power plants are subsidized, and a lot of the costs are being borne by the public and by the environment. But now, with these current reactors all becoming old, the average age of a nuclear power plant in the U.S. is 36 years, and more than half of them are older than 40 years. So these reactors were only licensed and expected to run for 40 years originally. And that was why the U.S. government, you know, made a point of trying to inspire the nuclear renaissance to start building new reactors to replace the old ones. Well, with the failure of the nuclear renaissance and the fact that building new nuclear reactors is not possible or desirable in the U.S. right now, the industry is trying to keep these old reactors going. The problem that they're having is that the cost of operating old nuclear reactors is skyrocketing because of the amount of maintenance that they require and the very high expenses for components and doing this kind of maintenance work on these old plants. And so, you know, while energy prices have gone down, while demand for electricity has gone down because of energy efficiency improvements, while renewable energy is growing at an increasingly fast rate because of the improving economics of renewables, the economics of nuclear power are going down the toilet. So now the industry has been pushing for more subsidies and bailouts for these old reactors, new subsidies for old reactors. And they started proposing these subsidies in 2014. And, you know, people at the state level were very effective at stopping them for those first 2 years. Unfortunately, the industry was able to get Governor Cuomo in New York to ram through a bailout of astronomical proportions last year, $7.6 billion for four aging reactors. And Illinois followed suit on the heels of that, so that essentially, you know, two states are now on deck to subsidize old reactors to the tune of $10 billion. And they're taking these proposals to other states where there's now bills, you know, potentially being in play in Connecticut, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey, and potentially other states to come. This is an issue that's of, you know, sort of massive, you know, national implications. And what's really outrageous about it is these same reactors were bailed out 20 years ago to the tune of $80 billion on their bad debts for building these nukes. And the idea was that by bailing them out 20 years ago, we were supposed to be free of consumers bearing the risk of nuclear power, the economic risks of nuclear power going forward. And here we are 20 years later, as the industry is on the verge of going out of business, with another round of bailouts that could essentially divert billions and billions of dollars away from clean energy investment into propping up old nukes.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Tim Judson from the American nonprofit watchdog called NIRS. And we're talking about the huge bankruptcy of Westinghouse Electric, the nuclear power subsidiary of the Toshiba Corporation. Well, Tim, the Toshiba Corporation isn't alone drowning in nuclear debt. What is the situation with the French nuclear power builder Areva?
Sure. Areva is, like Westinghouse, one of the flagship nuclear corporations in the world. Areva is a state-owned corporation, about 80 to 90% state-owned by the government of France, alongside Électricité de France, which is the French nuclear utility, which operates nuclear power plants. Areva has been sort of the contractor arm of the industry in France that designs and builds reactors, that mines and processes uranium, that reprocesses and manages nuclear waste and that sort of thing. They're also active in the U.S. and nuclear projects here as well. So Areva was, like Westinghouse, one of the flagship companies that was supposed to start this nuclear renaissance with new reactor designs that were supposed to be safer and more economical. And Areva actually went down the tubes faster than Westinghouse did. So Areva has been building two new reactors in China, two new reactors in Europe. They had proposed a few new reactors in the U.S. Again, like Westinghouse, all of those projects are billions of dollars above budget, years behind schedule, even further behind than the Westinghouse reactors are so far. And so Areva essentially went bankrupt last year, and essentially the company has been carved up to where EDF is now, or Électricité de France has now absorbed some parts of Areva's company, and then other parts of Areva are essentially being left to go fallow. And so what you have right now between Areva and Westinghouse, these are the only two corporations in the world that have been able to commercialize nuclear reactor designs that have actually been able to market and export new reactors and start building them. Both of these companies are going down the tubes because of what a failure building new nukes has become. And there's no one else on deck that's proved, you know, any other nuclear corporation in the world that's even proved able to get as far along as they have. So what's happening in nuclear power right now is sort of like if all of the major car companies went out of business and you couldn't buy any new cars. That is actually happening to nuclear power right now, where every company that has actually been manufacturing new reactors is on the verge of going out of business.
What about the British plans to build a new reactor? Is that going ahead even as wind, solar, and gas are way, way cheaper?
Well, what's happening in the UK is sort of on the tail end of all this. So there's a project called Hinkley Point C, which is a project to build two new reactors at an existing site in England. And so that was a project where Areva was contracted to build two of these new reactors, like those that are under construction in Europe and China. The feasibility of that project has been incredibly bad, from the start. And the projected cost of building it has varied from between $30 billion and $40 billion for two of these reactors. And in fact, until the new government was elected in the UK last year, there were expectations that Hinkley Point was going to go down the tubes, in part because of all the problems that are facing Areva and the French nuclear industry and their ability to finance the project, but also because of the improving economics of renewables and the fast rate of growth of solar and wind in the UK. The Theresa May government has essentially decided that they are going to prioritize nuclear over renewables, and the Areva board of directors and the EDF board of directors have decided that they can't afford to let this project go down the tubes yet. And so they've essentially created some incredible measures to be able to make Hinkley Point move forward, including a 30-year commitment by ratepayers in the United Kingdom to buy this electricity at twice the market rate of electricity in the UK right now. You know, it's questionable whether that project is ever going to be completed. They haven't really begun construction yet. And so there's at least, 5 to 10 years, along the way for Hinkley Point to go belly up in the same way that the projects in the U.S. seem to be.
You know, in my opinion, this has never been a business. It's always been a kind of a scam, as I said at the beginning of this program, to suck money out of the taxpayer and some executives make big money, but the public ends up poor in the future. Now, history is quite clear that the nuclear power industry was developed to keep materials and skills flowing into the nuclear weapons program. Does the Pentagon still need civilian nuclear power?
Well, it depends on what you think of the government's policy on nuclear weapons. you know, if we were really committed to a policy of disarmament in this country and, you know, in the phase out of nuclear weapons, then there's not much argument for, you know, for keeping a whole another side industry going in order to provide the technology and expertise necessary to do that. But what some British researchers did last year was they actually did a study to figure out why the British government was so committed to the Hinkley Point project. And they did surveys with policymakers and people in the industry, and the paper that they published concluded that the real thing that was driving the government's commitment to new nuclear power plants in the UK was wanting to be able to have the technical expertise and the industrial capacity to keep their nuclear submarine weapons program going. And so I think that probably the same is true in the U.S., that there's, you know, a deep institutional commitment within the federal government. The Department of Energy's primary business is managing the nuclear weapons complex, and there are now proposals to fund the revitalization and development of our nuclear weapons program to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars over the next several years. And so I think that there's that probably the same dynamic is in play here.
As you know, President Obama was friendly towards nuclear power. Some say he got campaign money from the industry. What have you heard about Donald Trump's relationship with the nuclear power industry?
Well, there's not much to be said about his past relationship. I mean, he's made favorable statements about nuclear power in the past, and he's certainly made some very troubling comments about nuclear weapons and our nuclear weapons program that suggests that he's very supportive of improving and increasing our nuclear arsenal. And so that's one of the concerns that we would have is that a Trump administration, with its commitment to dirty energy and to propping up dirty energy industries like coal and natural gas, that they could view nuclear in the same way, as well as see it having a national security interest in propping up nuclear power. It would be a terrible mistake to do that.
Well, now that America, France, and the UK, and many others are stuck with this nuclear power mess, is there any sane plan to get out of it?
Well, there's no plan by the U.S. government to get out of it. In fact, that's one of the things that we've been trying to bring to people's attention in questioning these bailouts that have been going on, is that essentially the energy industry, and from the federal government down to state regulatory agencies and policymakers and in the very communities that these power plants are in, have been whistling past the graveyard on what's happening with nuclear power. We had a meeting with the Governor Cuomo's administration in New York over 3 years ago to inform them that the economics of these nuclear power plants in New York were going down the tubes and that, in fact, these reactors might close early. And it was relevant because the state was developing its next 6-year energy plan. And we thought that they should be aware of it. They're planning on these nukes being in operation, that they needed to reevaluate that. And they should also be prepared for the industry to start coming to them for, you know, for subsidies in order to keep these plants profitable. We were virtually laughed out of the room with the idea that the Governor Cuomo, who was, you know, was trying to build a reputation as an advocate for clean energy and was working to shut down the Indian Point nuclear power plant near New York City, that he would ever consider subsidizing nuclear power. Well, what happened just 2 years later was that the governor was not only going along with a bailout, but he was actively pushing it. And what was really motivating that going on was essentially the industry making, you know, really serious threats to close nuclear power plants immediately, like within a matter of months, and potentially facing the governor facing a political problem with job losses in parts of the state where he's politically vulnerable. And what we see across from whether it's in New York or Illinois or these other states, what's driving the push for bailouts is that states have been asleep at the wheel, not paying attention to what's going on with nuclear power, assuming that these plants are always going to be cheap and they're always going to be there. And then companies like Exelon and Entergy coming forward with threats to close plants in a matter of months and not knowing what to do politically about the loss of jobs and property taxes and local economic impact. I mean, there needs to be a plan, and I think there are, you know, organizations like ours that are working on helping states develop plans to deal with reactor closures. But in terms of at the policymaker level, at the states and at the federal level, there's been a complete unwillingness to actually deal with this problem. And we know what's happening with coal. Coal plants have been closing over the last several years. You know, it's a well-understood trend that the coal is on its way out. People have not anticipated that happening with nuclear, and it's really caught policymakers by surprise.
Well, let's say there is a major nuclear accident in the United States, heaven forbid. The public demands an immediate shutdown of all nuclear plants. Do the lights go out, or are there enough other sources of power that we could cope somehow?
Sure. I mean, one of the problems that the nuclear industry is having in the U.S. is that we actually have an oversupply of electricity generation capacity. The competition to sell electricity on the markets is so stiff because there's such a huge supply that prices have gone down significantly. I mean, it's always a local question whether if a particular power plant shuts down, whether you need to take some measures to compensate for it. But, on a national basis, I think you can look to Japan and see what's happened there to get a clear sense of it. Japan was more dependent on nuclear power than the U.S. is before the Fukushima accidents. And essentially overnight, Japan went from 30% nuclear power to zero and effectively has been at zero for the last 2.5 years. And the lights haven't gone off in Japan. They have struggled and managed to keep the lights on through things like energy efficiency and energy conservation. But, renewables are growing at a pretty stiff clip. And what you see, the interesting story about Japan versus a country like Germany, where they're doing a planned nuclear phase out, is that in Japan, the nukes went off overnight. And, but the utilities have billions and billions of dollars invested in these plants, and they don't want to have to write them off and declare bankruptcy. And so the utilities have been getting in the way of what's the obvious solution to Japan's energy problem, which is that they should be investing in wind and solar and energy efficiency dramatically. But the utilities have been getting in the way of that and blocking renewable energy politically in Japan. The same problem could happen in the U.S. The U.S. public could turn, against nuclear power if there's another accident and demand that the reactors be shut down. But very powerful energy corporations could still interfere with having a plan for alternatives.
For a couple of decades, you and I have been fighting off craven nuclear promoters like Bjorn Lomborg and the Breakthrough Institute and well-meaning Greens like James Hansen and Mark Lynas. We said the nuclear industry is super dangerous, badly regulated, bound for bankruptcy. Now that's all come to pass, but it doesn't really feel like a win. People are saddled with risky rundown reactors and hundreds of billions more public debt. Tim Judson, is this a case where nobody wins?
Well, I mean, the path to winning is clear. In a sense, the way that the energy industry and the utilities in particular have managed to stall progress on the clean energy transition for decades has been by pitting consumers and environmentalists and labor against one another, by preventing the clean energy alternatives from coming to the fore, and by making the kind of political threats about job losses and everything else and skyrocketing energy prices and blackouts and that sort of thing for far too long. And so I think the propaganda that the energy industry has created for decades makes it seem like there's a zero-sum situation. We've got to accept, environmental pollution, nuclear catastrophe risks if we want to have our lights on and our energy cheap. The opposite is true now. I mean, the advances that have been made in energy efficiency and renewables and now new technologies like energy storage and smart grids and smart energy management mean that we're actually on the cusp of being able to completely transform our energy system over the next 10 to 20 years from one that's based on these dirty centralized power plants that are causing climate change and nuclear waste to a completely clean energy system that could actually rebuild our economy and save the planet. So the reality is just that, it's an inconvenient truth for the energy industry that the solutions are here.
Give us a brief snapshot of your group, the Nuclear Information Resource Service. What is it?
Sure. So we're an environmental group that was founded in 1978 to essentially be the sort of the nationwide information center and networking hub for grassroots activists across the country who are concerned about nuclear power and radioactive waste. So we have a small staff, but we work nationally supporting groups at the state and local level to be informed and engaged on nuclear issues and to run national campaigns when necessary, to be able to bring about the end of nuclear power and to ensure that communities aren't contaminated with radioactive waste.
We've been talking with Tim Judson. He's the executive director of the Nuclear Information Resource Service, or NIRS. You can find them at nirs.org. You can also find more links and news stories about the Toshiba Westinghouse bankruptcy in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Tim, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week. Now it's even easier to cruise Radio EcoShock shows and pass them on. Just search soundcloud.com for Radio EcoShock. You can listen to programs and music. It's easy to share the audio with others through any medium, including Facebook. Embed the audio in your blog if you want. Please help get the word out using our new SoundCloud platform. Of course, all our past programs are ready for listening, downloadings, or just pass on the link at our website, ecoshock.org. You can get a weekly reminder of each show via @EcoShock on Twitter, or have every program sent to you automatically via the iTunes podcast. Find a handy podcast button at ecoshock.org. You can use that with any podcast receiver. We need it all to get real science out there, plus answers from activists and leaders in safer alternative lifestyles. This show has no advertising budget and no promotion department. That's where you can and do help. Call it online evangelism if you want. Call it education about reality, but please pass this show and blog as far and wide as possible. Radio EcoShock is produced with a Creative Commons copyright. You can use it for anything except selling the audio or print to make money or to promote a product. Other than that, feel free to use the interviews or excerpts in your podcast, your online show, your low-power radio station, your blog, whatever. After all, we are trying to save the world.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
Salat, ships, batsad, mamnu'il, tajawal, ajakum, magav, hivrit, shili, hivrit, shel, shabat, haravit, shelcha, hiaravit, shel, shabak.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm your host, Nora Barrows-Friedman. We're back with filmmaker Udi Aloni, the director of Junction 48, who is in New York doing promotion for the film. He's on his way to Ann Arbor for the Palestine Film Festival and then off to France in early April. Udi Aloni, it's great to have you with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
It's my pleasure.
So Tamer talked about the process in writing the script, incorporating these aspects of Palestinian life in Lydd, from home demolitions to racism to constant police violence, but also about the life of regular people, family, career, love interests. You're a longtime filmmaker, writer, and activist. Tell us about how these stories were woven together in this film. What was most important for you to communicate to your audience?
You know, I really feel that because Tamer and me working together for 15 years, more or less, and first time I shot him in my first film, Local Angel, he was 24 or 23 years old.
Wow.
So I felt very familiar with Lydd, with the town that Tamer grew up and still lived there. And my feeling was that in order for us to deliver a true universal message, we have to be extremely particular in the details of what Lydd is, what is to be a Palestinian within Israel, what we call 40 acres. What is this place that you live apartheid that is not so obvious to the people out of Israel, because everyone thinks about Palestine as the West Bank, but they don't think about it as a place within Israel that the full culture is oppressed. And also what is to give this feeling and smell of the food, of the life, of the friendship, of the hood that he grew up. So I felt that what I want to say, I know what I want to say. I don't have to push it. My job as a filmmaker is to create this perfect feeling of the location that you almost will smell the maklube when you cook it. And if I do this right, I felt that the story will come out and what we want to say will be included with those details. So that's, I felt, more or less of my mission. The proof was that when we did, I wasn't happy how the maklube looked. After we finished everything and already in the editing room, it didn't look so much like a real maklube. I asked Tamer's mother to come to a whole shooting day to re-prepare a whole maklube that it will look a true one. So For me, this was that Tamer's mother's hand in the movie is something that show what the movie is all about.
Oh, that's fabulous. And in your work as a filmmaker, in the past, you've talked about creating this, what you called a binational language, in which to navigate a mutual space in Palestine, Israel, really working to implement, you know, a post-colonial culture, if you will. It was clear to me that this binational language, that intention of yours, is totally revealed in this film and how you directed it, and how you and Tamer and everybody in that community worked to portray life in Lydd without, you know, the certain heavy-handedness that some films about Palestine have to them. Can you talk about that? What that binational language is, and more about this intention in your directing of this film?
That's extremely important for me, and I'm so happy you asked about that. Well, I feel that in a way I have two big teachers for that. One is Edward Said, and especially the late Edward Said in his last book, I think, Freud and the Non-European. He really created this offering. He, in a way, was welcoming the Jews who come to Palestine, if only they can be able to think in a non-European way. And to create, and he offered this, to try to search for this binational language, which can be very, very good for the Jews and for the Palestinians in a way. And not by trying to merge to become one nation, but understand that you speak about two different nations and two different languages, but the tension and the dialogue between them can create a new place. That's what Said offered. And it was nice because he was reading Freud, reading Moses, Musa, and I was reading Said, reading Freud, reading Moses. So it created this kind of a continuity already that Palestinians and Jews are reading the text of the original prophet and bring it to this new place of secular, but yet ripe with a history of this place. The other one, and was the late Giuliano Melchamis, when he invited me to live in Jenin refugee camp with him, working in the Freedom Theater in Masach HaChoriyeh, to see Giuliano, that he's really is half Palestinian and half Jew, or we said 100% Palestinian and 100% Jew, and to see him working and me working with him to create theater, to create cinema, to create a language that can offering a new place, even in a place that it's so difficult, because Jenin refugee camp is the death symbol of oppression. Like, you see people who really came from a place that now is Israel, they're in camp and they have to see their houses just across the border that somebody else lives there. And in this place to offer also a productive or something with hope to this place that we live in was really teaching me. Giuliano teach me this, I said, the step of binationalism, how to move in this language. So, and I feel Giuliano was very important to Tamer and to me also. Dan came a few times to do performance in Jenin in the Freedom Theater.
Yeah.
And I think that when Tamer and me worked there, for us, binationalism, it's very important. It's not a dialogue. It's not, let Jews and Palestinians speak with each other. It's Jews and Palestinians together working first to create a full equality and fighting for the oppressed and fighting for the Palestinian. And really, when you saw the house demolitions, you forget that on top of it, there is something much stronger. There is the cultural demolition of the Palestinian people. The minute Tamer relates himself as Palestinian and not as Israeli Arab, the entire Israeli government go to try to destroy what is offered. So this binationalism is really the place to create the place between the river to the sea, a place that's not only just equal and justice, but also that offering something new to the world, a new possibility. And I think in this extremely pessimistic time now between Bibi and Trump and all the rest, yeah, everyone we mentioned will be part of them. For us to create this Noah Ark, we called it, this Noah Ark that's floating in this terrible flood around us, and keeping this new language and creating it, it's a little bit of optimism in this destruction world right now.
That's the voice of director Udi Aloni. Udi, you built the outdoor set for the home demolition scenes in the middle of this neighborhood. What was it like filming that and interacting with the community while home demolitions, as you said, like these have been rampant in Lid and other Palestinian communities for decades since the Nakba?
The truth that where we built the house for, you know, I built a totally full house because we really wanted to, you know, this scene is very realistic when even the crew and Tamer and the actor on Sama, when they saw the demolition, they start to cry almost as the real one because we make it so authentic. But the truth, I isolated it from the neighborhood. Everything you see there is totally controlled by the cinema. Sometimes, you know, the most true is the fiction and how you create it, because it was very difficult to put it really in the neighborhood as it is. It could be too traumatic to too many people. We were involving, unfortunately, many, tried to stop many house demolitions in Red. There are so many of them, and only for Palestinians. They approve retroactive houses of Jews, and then the Palestinians who live there for a long time are living with this threat that their house can be demolished every day. So we isolated where we shoot it, and we rebuild the house to demolish it. And it was so authentic that the city hall gave us a note to destroy, to demolish this house, because it looked such a real thing. So we almost wanted to wait for them to do it and save some money.
Oh, my God.
But I think that everyone that from the crew that was from Lid or other big cities experienced it. It was very difficult. It was really what you see. I really swear the tears that you see in the eye of the old man, of this amazing actor,
yeah.
Kupti, he came to me after, hugged me, and said, Udi, this was a real tear. Because I was so amazed how he acts so, you know, so authentic. And that touched me. It wasn't an easy moment to shoot that. We spent 2-3 days undo the demolition. We spend a month to build all the details correctly. So, yeah. But it's important to also mention, I think, the day after you see that there is a concert, a protest concert on the demolition house. And for Western people, it's really hard to think, how can they go and sing after the house was demolished? They don't understand, I think, the spirit of resistance, that you do cry on the demolished, but you really want to show that you can rebuild your place. There is a Bedouin village in the Negev, in the south, that they built their village 70 times or even more. Each time Israel come and demolish it, and they rebuild it.
Yeah, I think so, it's over 100 times now in Al Arqib.
Over 100 times now, so... And, you know, and we go into all of those places. We go into Umm al-Khiran, and I don't have words to explain it. You know, there is no, you know, I can't believe that like, people like Governor Cuomo here in New York, when he tried to put sanctions to put people who try to boycott Israel and to use nonviolence mean against this extreme violence of Israel. It's really make him, for me, look exactly like Trump. I don't see the difference. Because if once you experience a family, in my previous team, we saw it very well in Art Violence. It was in Lod. Tamer brought me there. We were standing all day there. The rain came. And when all the kids were in school, Israel came and destroyed totally their house. 50 kids, Israeli citizens, Palestinian Israeli citizens, very important. They came back. And they saw the house demolished. 50 kids came back from schools without home. That even according to the law, even if it would be illegal, they have to create first to prove to the court that there is a place for those kids to live. But when it's Palestinian, fair game, you know, who cares?
Yeah.
And for me, seeing that, I said that one day I have to show it so realistic to the world. Sorry, I got emotional at this because the image was appearing.
Yeah.
But now we can sing on the ruins as we do and rebuild it.
I think that's the only way forward, right?
It's the only way. Yeah. Once we stop doing it, it means that it's a full victory for them.
Yeah.
And they might win. You know, I don't know. We are not such as we are weak. We are not so strong. We have our art that cannot change at all. We have those amazing, dedicated people, but it's very difficult times now.
It is.
The film is going on next week on all online, iTunes, pay-per-view, all that, and there are still communities that can invite the film in different theaters around America through TAG, and I really want as many people to see this film. And because for us, it's a film that has to be first excellent film, of course, because as Giuliano said, high quality is the means of resistance. But we want also it to have a wake-up call to American citizens also to support the cause. So it has two different goals, or maybe it's the same goal. You know, it's always hard. We always separate between arts and politics as it's possible to separate between the two. While, of course, one without the other is meaningless. You know,
right.
Activist films that don't have art sometimes are against the cause because nobody wants to see them. Art that try to be just art without politics, that's only privilege can say them, not political. That's the beautiful song of Tamer, of Karim in the song, Anamish Politi, I'm not political. It's kind of a joke. Like, only privileged guy can see do art and say I'm not political and doing just art. You know, once you live in, you know, under oppression, everything you do is art. Even to do art is a resistance to the politics. Yeah.
Well, remind people how they can see the film and learn more about it, and hopefully they'll be. The film will be coming to their area, but if not, where can people go online to see it?
I think that if you go on the junction48.film, junction48.film, you can go and see through TAG all the places it's going to show in different neighborhoods, and also you can, communities can invite the film.
Great.
And from next Friday, it will be really many pay-per-view, on-demand, in iTunes. So people can go online and purchase it. So there are two. I like that community see it. And also, if sometimes when we are in the States, we love and speak with communities. We'll do it even in Palestine when it was out. And in Israel, we went to communities to show it, even though it was in main theaters, just to have this possibility to discuss, because the film speaks a lot about the relationship also between oppression and women's rights. We didn't speak about it so much here. But for us, it's very important, because sometimes if you just do a film about women's rights causes in Palestine, not mention that it's all a whole community under colonialist oppression, you're missing the fact that it's almost impossible for the women's rights to fight for themselves when they have to fight a national fight for independence. And Tamer and me and Giuliano before and all, we all the time, it was very important that it's the same fight. Fight for equality is always the same fight, and we have to reveal the problem everywhere. And I think that's why we were happy when Linda Sarsour was tweet our film to people, because she, in a way, is kind of the spirit of something that connect to what we do there. Yeah. But I think go online to this junction48.film. I think all the information is there.
Udi Aloni, thank you so much for your work and for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast. Good luck with the film.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on iTunes, support the Electronic Intifada podcast by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to talk to Jamie Swift about his new book, together with his co-author, Ian McKay, The Vimy Trap. And, of course, we're right on schedule. The Prime Minister was there. And we're going to get the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth about Vimy. And later in the show, we will talk to Stephen Gowans, who's going to be coming to Toronto. By the way, the co-author of The Vimy Trap, Ian McKay, is speaking tonight. Phil, where?
At the Steelworkers Hall, 25 Cecil Street at 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock.
So listen to the Taylor Report and run off down to Cecil Street.
Listen to Jamie Swift and then go see his co-author. And again, it's 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock, 25 Cecil Street, which is in the Spadina area, Spadina and Dundas.
Uh-huh.
And
okay. 7 o'clock right after this show, and it is Ian McKay. He's the co-author of The Vimy Trap. Subtitle, or How We Learn to Stop Worrying and Love the Great War. I think we're joined now by Jamie Swift. Are you there, sir?
I am.
Very nice to talk to you. I want to tell our listeners, this is a great book. Everybody should have it. It's the kind you really do need on your shelf. And actually, for your own self-protection, the subject of gas comes up. It seems to me right now we need our gas masks on because the Prime Minister spoke, and I checked all the headlines. And strikingly, the Toronto Star said, this is Canada at its best, is from the Prime Minister. And the Globe and Mail said, Canada at its best, which shows a little perspiration on their part to make sure to get this right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Montreal Gazette, was a little out of step. They had a headline from a 94-year-old man who said, "We didn't learn much, did we?" That was the headline.
Yeah.
Then checking, by the way, the net, I'm sure you know better than I do, can drive you crazy looking for headlines at what they're saying. But La Presse reported the Prime Minister as saying, here is where the birth of Canada. This is the birth of Canada.
Yes, he said that in French, oddly enough.
Yes, very daring. is that an observation or is that an order? Because your book, and I'm talking too much about it, is a great book. Everybody should have it. He had a father, Justin Trudeau had a father, and as you point out in the book, two guys who put on suited up for the war, Diefenbaker and Pearson, they never said that. So the son, Justin, has found something that they didn't know.
Well, so, I think that's true. I mean, this idea that Canada was born of war is rather puzzling. I would see it as sort of the Big Bang theory of Canadian origins, and the idea that a country can, be born in a war is puzzling. It speaks poorly of whoever's making that observation. But unfortunately, it's become increasingly common, and it's one of those stories that if it's told often enough and loudly enough, people might start to believe it, which is a bit worrisome, particularly because there was a great emphasis placed by the people we call in the book Vimyists,
yes,
on bringing high school students over to France yesterday it was, the centenary of the Battle of Vimy Ridge, and there's a lot of emphasis among some high school teachers on this idea, this, I think, rather nonsensical idea that Canada originated out of war. We don't think it's true. We think the book makes quite a concise and persuasive, evidence-based argument that the people who remembered what was called the Great War, because they were affected either directly by having participated or indirectly by having had relatives participate and often be killed or maimed physically or spiritually, the way they remembered the war in the 20s, 30s, and beyond was rather different. There was none of this drum and bugle patriotism that we see now. So what we try to do in the book is show how that what people thought in the wake of the war. And we're talking here about English Canada, of course, not of French Canada. It's not surprising that the Montreal papers were, should we say, somewhat more circumspect with respect to how the war is remembered than the Toronto press and so on. So we argue in the book that it's not the birth of a nation. It would be, if you accept that, then you have to ask the question, the birth of which nation? Because, of course, Quebec was dead set against the war. I went to the Vimy Memorial where Mr. Trudeau spoke yesterday, and I looked at the names of what are called the fallen, which is a euphemism for people who were drowned in mud or blown to bits too small to ever recover.
11,000, am I right?
11,000 killed and wounded at Vimy Ridge. But on the monument itself, these are all the Canadians, I think, who went missing in the Western Front. I think in France. I could be wrong. In any case, they're alphabetical, and I counted over 40 men by the name of Taylor who went missing, and I counted but one man by the name of Tremblay. Tremblay, of course, is one of the most common names in Quebec.
Mm-hmm.
So that is an indication that there was a pretty fair split there. And also, I think it's important to note that Vimy Ridge produced so many casualties that it accelerated the pressure on the Canadian government to bring in conscription, which, of course, in that very year, 1917, really fractured Canada and threatened its very existence.
Yeah, it didn't pull us together going up the hill. It almost tore us apart. I was very struck by it, and thank you for the book for pointing this out. You have the four divisions, heroically, the high diction, going up the hill. But a month later or two, the prime minister visits and he goes home and he says, now we're going to have conscription, and all hell broke loose.
Yes, yeah. So the idea of, again, to return to Mr. Trudeau, that Canada was born at Vimy Ridge is, to repeat, which Canada, number one? And you'd think somebody who... whose father was a notable Quebecer, who, of course, his political career was based on opposition to Quebec nationalism, so Trudeau Sr. would have been very aware of this. Yes. Of this. Now, it's interesting, though, too, that Trudeau Jr., Justin Trudeau, appeared as an actor in a CBC production about World War I, and he played a man named Talbot Papineau.
Oh my goodness.
Who was a famous, sort of a great white hope for Canadian unity. His father was, Talbot Papineau was a descendant of Louis-Joseph Papineau and a Philadelphia mother.
Mm-hmm.
So Trudeau plays Talbot Papineau in this TV docudrama that was on CBC a few years ago, obviously. And the last words of Talbot Papineau before he goes over the top, I believe it's at Passchendaele, he says to one of his comrades, Huey, this is suicide. And Talbot Papineau was immediately killed. So I guess Mr. Trudeau has some sort of residual romantic attachment to this fairy tale of Canada being born at Vimy Ridge.
Well, certainly your book militates against romanticism, song, this tendency of high rhetoric. You call it high diction.
Yeah, after
which
Paul
is,
Fussell.
It's an irritating part of it. We're all familiar with this. We go into a courtroom and they say, take the gum out of your mouth, or you go to the church and they say, keep still. And that's where you hear high diction.
Mm-hmm.
So with Vimyism, they seem to be trying to silence people, which makes your book rather brave, by the way.
Yeah, well, I think when you do talk about this kind of thing in a critical way, the first thing you can be or are often accused of is being, besmirching or bad-mouthing the memory of the soldiers who were killed at Vimy Ridge or in any other war. So I think we have to put that aside. A critique of the war and the reasons for a war and the way the war is subsequently romanticized is quite distinct from an appreciation of the efforts of the people who fought and died on our side. And I think one of the things about Vimyism, or this Anglo-Canadian militarized patriotism, is that it's really all about us. It's a giant English-Canadian selfie, if you will, because we don't talk about the massive losses of life on the German side, and those losses are just as tragic as the losses on the Canadian side. And in that context, keeping that in mind, that sort of what you could call a post-patriotic understanding of that battle and that war, we have to keep in mind that the Vimy Memorial that people, the listeners, may have seen on TV yesterday, or certainly have seen if they take out their wallet and look at a $20 bill, there it is. The man who sculpted and designed the Vimy Memorial, Walter Allward, a Toronto sculptor, is his life's work, his masterpiece. He spoke of it as a sermon against the futility of war, and that's a direct quote from Allward. His memorial, one of the most important statues, I think, shows one of the figures breaking his sword, which is a direct biblical reference, of course, to thou shalt beat thou thy swords into plowshares. So again, that the memorial itself is a peace monument, but what we've heard over the past few days, the words peace were, the word peace was not often mentioned, and the words valor and heroism and this kind of thing, this what you refer to as high diction, that tended to predominate, and so there's a jarring disconnect between the message of the monument and the message that was put out by the government and by NGOs like the Vimy Foundation. I was on a train the other day, Toronto to Kingston, where I live, and they were VIA was handing out to every passenger a little Vimy pin with a little card attached saying that Vimy was the birth of a nation. So this is on the government-owned railway.
That doesn't work. It just, you know, it's it hurts the ear when you, as you point out, because we minimally are two nations, probably three.
Yeah.
And it's official, by the way. I mean, I was there when Parliament said that Quebec was a nation. So have they erased that? Do I no longer remember?
Well, that's, you know, it is
sure,
on, the Quebec,
Souvienne.
On the Quebec license plate. It is Souvienne.
Well, I have to ask you, go ahead.
I think if you want to, you know, look, if anybody interested in this should go on to the Veterans Affairs Canada website and look under Vimy events, of which there are dozens, and see just how many are being or have been held in Quebec versus in English Canada, and of the events being held, the Vimy events being held in Quebec, how many are Anglophone events and how many are Francophone events. I think that people would find that comparison telling.
Yes, I understand, by the way, there's a new popular hit song by a man named Richard Desjardins, out now, called Vimy, and the last words are, it was worthless, or words to that effect, futile,
really?
Worthless.
Richard Desjardins. Well, yeah. I should look that up.
It's just
haven't
out,
heard about that.
And that's what all Quebecers are listening to, and apparently they enjoy it.
Well,
of course, we know nothing about them. They live under a language code, so they're hidden there.
There was a fuss. A year or so ago in Montreal, there's a park in Outremont, which is a Francophone suburb, an affluent Francophone suburb, of not a new suburb, an old suburb in Montreal, and it was called Parc Vimy. And the good burghers of Outremont decided to change the name to Parc Jacques Parizeau. Of course, Mr. Parizeau was famously the Quebec nationalist premier, PQ co-founder almost, and this caused the hair in Anglo-Montreal to catch fire because Vimy was kicked out, and Jacques Parizeau, who's often disdained by Anglo-Montreal. So part of a park in Notre-Dame-de-Grâce, NDG, has been renamed for Vimy. So even today,
so Vimy's on the move.
Like Montreal, yeah, it's the commemoration and memory are contested terrain, I think.
Yeah, yes, somebody wanted to invent a game, said they were going to create a game called Predict the Past.
Yes.
And I read your book, and the past has been moving around, like a cockroach. It's really hard to find. Those guys who gathered in 1936 that you described, they didn't say any of the things or think any of the things that the people did yesterday.
Yeah, I think you're referring there to the unveiling, the inauguration of the Vimy Memorial in France. And we argue in the book that the predominant theme at that gathering, to which several thousand Canadians came, and they had to come by ship, was never again and peace. Yep. And notably, Canada's first Silver Cross mother, Mrs. Charlotte Susan Wood, was there in 1936 at the Vimy Memorial, and Mrs. Wood had had five sons killed in Britain's Imperial Wars, the youngest of whom, Percy, was killed at Vimy Ridge. He was 17 years old. And Mrs. Wood, who was a working-class woman, a laundress from Winnipeg, was there, and she got to meet the king. And she said to the king as she looked down over the former killing field, "You know, I really still wonder why our boys had to go through all that." So that's an important statement. Yes. From somebody who had reason to question the war, and she did so.
You could not tell her not to say that. five sons. This is Jamie Swift. The book is Vimy, The Vimy Trap, pardon me, and his co-author is Ian McKay. And Ian McKay is going to be talking at 7 o'clock at Steelworkers Hall at 25 Cecil Street today. So please, everybody, turn out for that. Everybody has to get a copy of this book. This is very important for the understand war and understand this country. I got to tell you, you have a picture that is a punch in the stomach to a lot of people. I think it's great. You have a photograph of the famous John McCrae, pardon me. He wrote In Flanders Fields, and tears get in the corner of everybody's eyes. Soldier, physician, McCrae. And he was a patriotic imperialist who ached, those are the quotes, ached for war. And during the conscription election, McCrae wrote, "I hope I stabbed a French Canadian with my vote." I did not know he had said that.
Yeah, that's in a letter from McCrae to his mother. It must have been written right after the famously, bitterly corrupt 1917 election over conscription that divided Quebec from English Canada. And I think that was, typical of a lot of Anglo-Canadian.
Yeah, he was fighting
all,
for he was fighting for empire.
He was, yes. He was, as you said, quite keen on war. He went to the South African War, which was a war in which Canada participated, and the war was aimed not at the liberation of the African majority in South Africa, but it was fought so that British mining interests could gain control over rich South African mineral deposits. So, this is the kind of feeling or thinking that suggests that the wars that Canada has fought have always been fought for freedom and democracy. And this is something we quote in the book that our current Governor General has argued, David Johnston, that Canada's wars have all been fought for democracy. It's a very, very puzzling notion to anybody who really understands anything about history.
And the fellows who served, who thought they were fighting for king and country and empire, right? For the empire.
Well,
and on all sides, actually, also the Austrians and the Germans, they were fighting for an empire as well.
Well, on one level, that's true, but I think I've read enough, probably too much, about war, and one of the most commonplace and accurate observations about war and soldiers is that when it comes down to the actual struggle, incredible levels of violence. What motivates soldiers is not high ideals of freedom and, patriotic flag waving. They're fighting for the small gang of men with whom they've been living and suffering in the trenches and, drinking and carousing and all, this kind of thing creates a very special bond between people. Anybody yes. who's ever been involved in a cause knows yes. that this kind of thing is it's a sort sure. of a social glue,
sure. it's a group shared,
dynamic that
shared
gets created.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what people, men in, say, at the Battle of Vimy Ridge, I would suggest, really were fighting for.
Yes.
They were fighting to win and, continue living, but they were fighting for their buddy.
Yes. Again, it's Jamie Swift, and it's called The Vimy Trap. And there's another matter which I had not realized until I read this book, and that is that prior to the attack, the Canadian forces had used gas, and you quote a Canadian military historian said, sure, it was efficient. It worked. But that day it didn't work. But tell about the gas involved, because we have gas issues or chemical issues going on right now, and our prime minister says, yep, we got to go to war over that.
Or yeah.
Go ahead and talk about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, everybody knows that gas was chemical warfare was widely used and essentially introduced during the First World War. The Germans used it famously in the Second Battle of Ypres, and the Canadians were involved in that. But the Canadians and the British were just as avid practitioners of poison gas warfare as were the Germans. In the period before, a matter of weeks before the Battle of Vimy Ridge, the Canadian soldiers, officer class, decided they'd stage a very big trench raid, not a full-scale assault, but a raid. So they deployed a fair amount of poison gas, but unfortunately they didn't gauge the wind correctly, and the gas either blew back or settled in shell holes where the Canadian soldiers were obliged to try to get away from enemy fire, and so they got poisoned by their own gas. So this was not uncommon during the Great War. But, that's, again, one of the great tragedies of this particular war that is not much talked about during the ceremonies that focus on what I called before the Great Big Bang theory of Canadian history and Canada's national origins.
Again, as Jamie Swift, the book is The Vimy Trap. And lastly, Pierre Burton said he's our greatest soldier, and that would be the General Curry. I learned, by the way, as a result of your stimulus of your book, he came to Canada originally as an Irish Catholic. The family changed their name to Curry from Carrington, and he became a Methodist. And then he's our greatest soldier, not that that's related, but he had some you quote a veteran novelist who wrote about it, who spoke of his rhetoric as a claptrap.
Mm.
You have also a relatively low opinion of him. Talk about him briefly, if you would.
Well, Curry is I saw a piece, I think it was in the Globe and Mail today, or maybe it was in the Toronto Star, saying that Curry should be posthumously elevated in rank to a field marshal.
Oh, why not?
From a general to honor what a great man he was. Two things about Curry. One, he was an embezzler. He managed to shift some funds before the war away from a group of soldiers he wanted to raise contribute to raising his own regiment. But he got into trouble in a BC real estate deal, and so the money mysteriously made it from one pocket to the other. So that's an interesting thing. Yes, apparently. And also the idea that Canada was this autonomous military force in World War I, particularly because of the Battle of Vimy Ridge. Well, in fact, subsequent to the Battle of Vimy Ridge, we have the equally awful and bloody Battle of Passchendaele. And Arthur Currie thought that Canada shouldn't participate in that because it would be a mass slaughter. This is where Talbot Papineau was killed. And he said suggested to Haig, who was the overall commander, that the Canadians, you know, shouldn't be involved. But he was overruled, and the Canadians were involved, and they died by the thousands. Mm-hmm. So that sort of sheds a
So he didn't get authority. He didn't have a kind of a lift from his great victory that they listened to him. They ignored him.
Well, in that case, yes. He was sort of in a subaltern position. He was an underling of General Haig, and Haig thought, you know, the attack on Passchendaele, which was notoriously muddy, and bloody, huge butcher's bill on both sides, and, you know, Mate Curry might have been sensible enough to say, hey, this might not be a good idea, but as I said, you know, he was overruled there.
Not a good idea, but you know best.
Yeah.
Jamie Swift, it's a great book. We're so glad we talked to you because maybe we won't fall into the Vimy trap.
Let's hope not.
If we read the Vimy traps, and your colleague Ian McKay is speaking tonight at the Steelworker Hall, 25 Cecil Street. You're going to be in Toronto at Central Library on the 18th.
Yeah, that's a week tomorrow.
A week tomorrow, Toronto Central Library. Just people check that. We think it's probably about 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock, I think it is.
7 p.m.
At the main library.
Well, thanks for that book. And we look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Sure thing. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
A beginning. It has begun. Today marked the second day since I began the treatment regimen of direct-acting antiviral drugs, or DAADs, designed to eliminate hepatitis C from my system. You, the people, made this possible. You, the people, filled two courtrooms in Scranton in December 2015. You, the people, supported our lawyers, Brett Grote of Abolitionist Law Center of Pittsburgh and Bob Boyle of New York City, as well as Dr. Joseph Harris, M.D., who diagnosed me as I was nodding in and out in a wheelchair in a prison visiting room, and later served as an expert witness in our hearings in Scranton. You, the people, sent love, prayers, letters, cards, money, and strength to us all, for which the words, I thank you, seem pale in comparison. Yet, I thank you still. You, the people, are helping me heal. The battle isn't over, but this is a damn good beginning. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. at least according to the press, was the sexual scandal involving his young intern, a woman not his wife. When the scandal almost engulfed his presidency, he ordered missile attacks on a pharmaceutical factory in the Middle East, Al-Shifa. The critics of Clinton called the weaponry Monica bombs, meant to deflect the rising flood of scandal. President Trump's bombing of a Syrian airfield, with scant proof of Syrian state involvement in a recent chemical weapons attack, seems like a Clintonian move to me. In March 1995, the Japanese religious cult Aum Shinrikyo released sarin in several subway cars, holding thousands of people, while nearly 5,000 people suffered injuries. Yes, guess how many died? 12. With this release in Syria, with thousands exposed, it's mathematically unlikely that 100 people died, given its open-air dispersal. It's equally unlikely that Trump cares a fig about Arab babies, no matter how beautiful they are. Wars create nations of losers, as Iraq rightfully revealed. Who are the winners here, besides weapons manufacturers? Wars are fought for two things, pretexts and profit from imprisoned nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Icon known as WRTI doing commercials and commentaries. Can students have an impact, not just on campus, but in the community? My answer, of course. Because most students are young. They don't yet have kids. Because of that, you're now living your freest selves that you will ever be. For many, it's your first time being away from home. Also, you're reading about facts, ideas, histories, narratives that you never heard of in high school, nor ever saw on TV. So I say enjoy that freedom, relish it, but also use it. What you learn today will cast light or shadow on your lives to come. So dare to learn, dare to study, dare to question, then dare to act. In many ways, schools seek to mold you, to tame you, to teach you obedience and acquiescence. There's a reason why fields of study are called disciplines. It's not by accident. I think education should be for liberation. It should lead you to ask questions and then to answer them for yourself. For blacks in America, the simple act of reading was once a serious crime. Education opened the cages of bondage. So study, dare to learn, dare to act. Study as if your life depended on it, for in a way, it does. For your life is your mind. And the struggle for freedom in America has ever been the right to think your own thoughts, to swim in your own ideas. Remember this. Youth make the revolution. Almost always. Castro in Cuba was a very young man when he began the struggle. Huey P. Newton, who co-founded the Black Panther Party with Bobby Seale, was all of 24 years old. 24. So don't say what you can't do. Do what you want to do. Think on this. Education is for liberation. So thanks, Brandon. Thanks to Black and Brown Coalition, the Black Student Union, the Haitian Students Union, the Asian Students, and Black Law Students. I love you all. Keep working. Keep doing what you're doing. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Thank you.
light of the significant events emerging in Syria, the Global Research News Hour presents this special repeat broadcast, originally airing January 13, 2017. Stephen Gowans, who appears near the end of the show, is on a special six-city Canadian book tour. For details, please visit gowans.wordpress.com. What are the realities on the ground affecting the people in Syria? Are the people of Aleppo threatened more by the Syrian airstrikes or by the militant opposition factions on the ground? Could mainstream Western media and human rights bodies like Médecins Sans Frontières and Amnesty International be deceiving the world about the human rights situation throughout Syria? Is there a Syrian civil war pitting a popular internal resistance against a brutal despotic government, or is this an invasion in disguise? What are the true aims behind U.S.-NATO efforts to delegitimize President Bashar al-Assad? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we hear an extensive interview with Canadian writer and independent journalist Ava Bartlett about her reporting from Syria and about the media's distortion of the situation there. Then we speak to Stephen Gowans, Ottawa-based author of a new book on the Syrian conflict. He debunks misconceptions about a popular resistance in Syria and about the West's true aims in the region. On this week's program, what's really going on in Syria? Conversations with Ava Bartlett and Stephen Gowans. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 13th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. CIA was bluffing, produced no evidence. Russians did not hack the election. Is this the beginning of the end of the deep state in the USA? Can Trump clean house and wage peace? Aided by enormous restraint on the part of Vladimir Putin, president of Russia, the soft coup in the USA has collapsed. Not only has the US intelligence community lost all semblance of credibility with incoming President Donald Trump, but the blackmail by the Central Intelligence Agency of Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham has been revealed by investigative journalist Wayne Madsen. That comes from the article, "The Soft Coup Collapses, CIA Bluffing, Russia Did Not Hack, Blackmail Revealed, What Next?" by Robert David Steele, posted January 9th. With so much power and authority, like those attributed to top intelligence agencies proclaiming that President Putin directed cyber attacks against fair and democratic U.S. election, who would not believe it? That's heavy stuff. You would think that such agencies must have serious sources and made serious analyses to come unanimously to the same results. Russia is guilty. It makes you forget, or at best confused, in the light of their conclusion to the contrary before. So, all the doubters around the globe, reset your thinking. The CIA says so, and they are most likely helped by their pal in crime, Mossad. But that nobody is supposed to know. That comes from the article, "Russian Cyber Attacking, When the Most Flagrant Lie Becomes the Truth," by Peter Koenig, posting January 10th. Trump nominated Steven Mnuchin, a 17-year veteran of Goldman Sachs, to be his Treasury Secretary. Stephen Bannon, another former Goldman Sachs banker, was named by Trump as his chief strategist in the White House. The sitting president of Goldman Sachs, Gary Cohn, has been named by Trump as director of the National Economic Council, which, according to its website, coordinates policymaking for domestic and international economic issues. Last week, in a move that stunned even Wall Street, Trump nominated a Goldman Sachs outside lawyer, Jay Clayton, of Sullivan and Cromwell, to serve as Wall Street's top cop as chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Adding to the slap in the face to Trump's working class supporters, Clayton's wife currently works as a vice president at Goldman Sachs. That comes from the article, "Here's How Goldman Sachs Became the Overlord of the Trump Administration," by Pam Martins and Russ Martins, posted January 10th, originally appearing at Wall Street on Parade. It was Secretary of State Kissinger who asked his good friend David Rockefeller to facilitate Nixon's China opening to the West in 1971. Then, the geopolitical aim of Kissinger's rebalance was to seduce China, then the weaker of Washington's two great adversaries, into the Western alliance against the Soviet Union, then the stronger adversary, at least in military and geopolitical terms. Today, as the year 2017 begins, the roles have turned, and clearly China has emerged after more than three decades of unbridled industrial and economic expansion as the stronger challenger of David Rockefeller's so-called world government. Russia, following the economic savagery and deindustrialization of the post-1991 Yeltsin years, is, in Kissinger's view, clearly the weaker of his two adversaries. Both China and Russia, under Xi Jinping and Putin, are, together with Iran, the most formidable defenders of national sovereignty, the main obstacles standing in the way of David Rockefeller's, I use him as the template, world fascist government. That comes from the article, "Billionaires to Key Cabinet Ministers. Is Donald Trump the backdoor man for Henry A. Kissinger and Company?" by F. William Engdahl, posted January 10th, originally appearing at New Eastern Outlook. Since 1953, Cuba has been and continues to be the quintessence of cultivating ideological principles. Every written and spoken word of Fidel is impregnated with ideology. It is not stagnant. On the contrary, it is continuously evolving according to the context. Otherwise, Cuba would not have been able to outlast its enemies all this time. I am convinced that one of the main implicit objectives of the international corporate media campaign against the persona of Fidel right after his passing was imperialism's revenge against him for not capitulating on ideology. That comes from the article, "The End of Ideology in Cuba," by Arnold August, posted January 10th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Ava Corrine Bartlett is an independent Canadian journalist, writer, and rights activist who has done extensive reporting from Gaza and has documented the Israeli bombing campaigns on that territory while riding in ambulances and reporting from hospitals. She's visited Syria six times since April of 2014 and was in Aleppo twice, including during the month of November. She's about to embark on a tour of Canadian cities to share her understanding of the conflict in that country, which wildly contradicts mainstream Western media narratives. Well, being this the show this is, we just had to bring her on to enlighten us about her viewpoints. So, Eva Bartlett, thank you very much for joining us on the Global Research News Hour.
Thank you very much for having me. It's an honor. I have a lot of respect for the authors and people who contribute to Global Research. I will just note, point. I've actually been in Aleppo four times, and I only mention that because it is relevant in terms of combating the lies that the media have been saying about Aleppo.
Okay, well, thank you for that clarification. So first off, I just wanted to give you a chance to maybe give us a little bit more detail about your background, help share an understanding of who you are to our audience. I mean, you say, I think that you've stated that there other than two international delegations that you participated in Syria, you were financed on your own dime for the others. And you're not making a lot of money with this kind of reporting. So what exactly motivated you in the first place to take on the task of reporting from these war-torn regions?
It's the same kind of drive that drove me to go to occupied Palestine in the first place, because basically my entire adult life until my late 20s, I was completely politically unaware and naive. And then just by happenstance, when I was teaching English in South Korea, I came across online media that was talking about what was happening in Palestine, and I was shocked. And I mean, that's how naive I was. And I think it's good for people to know that, because there's a reason, I believe, that I wasn't informed on many issues, and that is what we're going to be talking about today, and that's the media and what the media allows us to know or to be concerned about. So in around 2007, I first went to Occupied Palestine, and this is all, you know, documented, or it's public knowledge. So anyway, I spent about 8 months in the Occupied West Bank volunteering and seeing, you know, awful atrocities committed by the Israelis against the Palestinians. And later I sailed to Gaza from Cyprus and spent a collective 3 years there, documenting not only the Zionist crimes against Palestinians when they commit massacres against Palestinians, but also the daily crimes of, you know, imposing a brutal siege on the people of Gaza, and also firing at farmers and fishers when they just simply try to eke out a living. So when things started in Syria, I had absolutely no knowledge about Syria, no prior ideas, but I was aware of what had, you know, what was happening in Libya, the crimes against the people of Libya and Gaddafi, and what had happened, obviously, to the people of Iraq, all by the same NATO alliance. And so I started paying attention to independent media like Global Research and other sites and started trying to get informed. I was still living in Gaza until about March 2013. And when I did come back to Canada, then I started talking with Syrians in Canada and trying to get their perspective on things. And then, as you mentioned, one of the two delegations I joined to go to Syria, the very first time I went to Syria in April 2014, was with an international delegation of concerned rights activists who wanted to go in solidarity, but also to, you know, be in Syria and meet with people and get their perspective on what was happening. So that was the introduction to my continued visits to Syria. And as you mentioned, except for the two delegations, I've gone independently. I've gotten the visa on my own, waited extended periods to get that visa, and then, you know, taken a shared taxi from Beirut to Damascus, and then arranged things on my own from within Syria. So I guess that context is important because we'll probably touch on this, but there's been some media campaigns against people like myself, not exclusively against me, but essentially against people who the media is now dubbing fake news, who dare to contradict the corporate narrative on what's happening in Syria. And one of the slander campaigns has been because of all the publications, including mostly non-paid, that I contribute. I also have contributed a total of 8 op-eds to Russia Today. Some people who want to try to discredit what I'm sharing, which is the voices of Syrians I've encountered on these 6 visits, including extensive travel, you know, 2 months this summer and a month in October, November, as well as prior visits, these smear campaigns are trying to discredit the voices that I'm simply trying to transmit to people by calling me a Russian agent simply because I've contributed 8 op-eds to RT. So long answer. basically, you know, it's devastating what's happened to the people of Syria, and our media, aside from the good independent alternative media like Global Research and others, our media has been a shamefully complicit vehicle to transmit war propaganda and confuse people on what's really happening in Syria.
Ava, do you think you could maybe, like, I'm sure you did your research in advance of going down there, but I am curious to know what your impressions of the Syrian people were when you got there. I mean, I imagine for a lot of Canadians, maybe not necessarily the listeners of this program, but, you know, may just have a kind of an idea, largely fostered by the media, I suspect, of these Syrians as these poor, underprivileged people, victims of fate, you know, under this dictatorial government, and they're in this Islamic country, and this, us compassionate Canadians have an obligation to allow all those refugees to come to this country and shower our compassion on them and use principled leadership at the UN. Does that depiction coincide with your understanding, having been there?
That made me laugh out loud because that is a depiction of the corporate media and so-called human rights groups and Western leadership. And when you go to Syria, you find overall a largely educated people, because you have to bear in mind, unlike our system, education is free there, and people obtain high degrees of higher education. You find people, it's a very secular society, so our media paints everything that's happening in Syria as a sectarian war, but you go to Syria, and Syrians, you can find Sunni Muslim women unveiled and beautiful and, you know, in the present, you know, mixing with, you know, it's not sectarian, basically. You find them mixing with Christians, with Shia, with whatever, Alawi, and they define themselves as Syrian, and they're proudly defiant. They, I mean, overwhelmingly, this is not to say everybody supports President Assad, but overwhelmingly they do. And when I say this again, just like people have tried to paint me as a Russian agent, then people will say, well, she's an Assad propagandist. Look, go to Syria and decide for yourself. You can go to these so-called rebel areas and you'll find a different sentiment, but these are by and large the minority. You go to Damascus, Homs, Aleppo, like I have, to various other areas, and you'll find that people support him, some to the degree that they actually love him and wear T-shirts with his image on it, others because they believe him to be a unifying force. But certainly, above all, they don't see him as the issue in Syria. They are, I mean, again, when things started in 2011, I wasn't there, but I have talked with many people who even participated in protests, and they weren't participating against Assad. They were participating for political changes, and this is what they've told me. And many of these people that I've met that had participated in protests, they said from very early on, they realized something was wrong. These weren't protests for political change. These were empty slogans. These were slogans including kill the Alawis and drive Christians into Lebanon. And, you know, people who did participate in this protest, many of them, even at the time, might have had feelings against Assad. I know somebody, a dear friend from Ma'loula, who for no particular reason didn't particularly like Assad. But over the years, he's come to realize that, in fact, President Assad's handling the situation in Syria with incredible, anyway, he's changed his views, and he sees that he supports Assad. And by and large, the sentiment you'll get there is that this is not about Assad. This is about the mercenaries, the terrorists that have invaded our country, that are slaughtering and beheading and mutilating our people and destroying our heritage. Okay. So and the other thing you hit on is no, it's not Syrians, just like it's not in Palestine. It's not these people saying, please help us, please UN give us aid. In both situations, they're saying stop the violence against us. That's all they want. They're a very, you know, dignified people, very resourceful people. They don't want NGOs. They don't want these Save Aleppo campaigns. They want, and thankfully, Aleppo is now liberated. But what they wanted all these years is just to stop the terrorists from sending bombs onto them or besieging them. And this is the same in other areas that are still besieged, like Fou and Kafaya. You know, when we talk about the UN, the UN has been a large part in obfuscating the reality in what's happening in Syria. For example, earlier this year, if I may go on, we're in 2017 now. At the beginning of 2016, there was a sudden overnight campaign of Save Madaya, and everybody, all the media were talking about Madaya, and there was Facebook campaigns about Madaya. Nobody at that time, including the UN, was talking about Fou and Kafraya. Fou and Kafraya are two villages in Idlib in western Syria that have been fully besieged since March 2015. And the United Nations, even in March 2015, when the siege came into place by these different so-called rebel factions, including Ahrar al-Sham and al-Nusra, when the siege was fully in place on Fou and Kafraya, United Nations expressed, you know, their usual grave concern, and then basically said nothing about it. And at one point, I looked at the OCHA, the Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, the division of UN, and I looked at their tweets just out of curiosity, and you know, I counted the number of times they tweeted anything about Fou and Kafraya, and compared that to Madaya, and the difference was astounding. So the situation in Madaya was that in October 2015, UN and Red Cross and I think Red Crescent agencies took in food and aid into Madaya. That's October 2015, and the ICRC spokesperson said the people of Madaya had enough aid to last for several months. Come January 2016, suddenly everybody was saying Madaya is starving, and all the blame was put on the Syrian government. And at the same time, when, as I mentioned, Fou and Kafaya were severely besieged, nobody was talking about them. So it was clearly a campaign to, again, vilify the Syrian government. And by the way, when RT journalist Murad Ghazdiev went into Madaya with an aid shipment, might have been later in January or early February, he talked with the people, and they were saying, the rebels or the terrorists have taken the food. There is food, but we don't have access to it. And this is the same situation that played out in Aleppo.
So they'd say you're like basically talking about unbalanced reporting, but to put it mildly. But I mean, I'm wondering, I feel like I have to ask you this just for the sake of some skeptical listeners, but if you could just sort of establish the integrity of your own reporting in the sense like, okay, when you talk to these people, exactly like what are you asking them? And are you being directed by Syrian government officials and they're saying, oh, you can talk to those people over there, but don't talk to those people over there, that kind of thing? I mean, how, you know, can we trust that you're getting a fairly fair appraisal of what the mood is? Maybe you're not, there are the Assad critics that you're just not able to get to or not to, you know.
Well, I mean, to some extent that's true in that I haven't gone to, say, areas occupied by al-Nusra, where the so-called FSA, the Free Syrian Army, are, and other so-called rebels that the West still insists on calling moderates, even though they have committed massacres from the very early, you know, months of 2011. I haven't talked with these so-called rebels. And so in that sense, people could accuse me of bias. But the reason I haven't talked with these so-called rebels is because I don't feel the need to validate them. You know, the majority of them are outsiders and are funded by the very states that are waging and that have premeditated this war in Syria, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the West, the NATO alliance, Turkey. And so, no, I haven't spoken with those. However, I have met with the Minister of Reconciliation and with internal opposition parties who are not armed and not funded by the West. And other than that, you know, in my meetings with Syrians, by and large, what I try to convey, yes, I've met with political and religious figures in Syria, in the government, but most of the reports I've written have been to take the testimonies of people from areas where they've been suffering. So, for example, I went to Homs many times. I went to Homs in June 2014, about, I think it was 1 month, if I remember correctly, after the rebels that were in Homs in the old city had been taken out in a deal that saw them transported elsewhere to Syria in order to bring peace to the old city. And I interviewed, and in fact, at that point, I was with a dear friend who was translating for me, but I also speak Arabic. So the point of having a translator was to ensure that I had, you know, 100% accuracy, but I could understand what was being said. And so I was speaking with this family and taking their testimony, what was life like under the so-called rebels. And obviously what they were saying contradicted what, you know, corporate media was saying. And they were saying the same kind of things that people in Madaya, where I have not gone, or people in Aleppo, where I have gone, were saying. And that is, you know, they were being terrorized and the so-called rebels had taken their food. I also spoke with somebody who knew the Jesuit priest, Father Franz von der Lute, in the old city of Homs. And he gave his account of how this priest was assassinated by one of these rebels. And so, you know, I was with this person that was translating for me, and offhand, I don't remember if there was somebody from the Ministry of Information with me. But even in instances when there has been somebody from the Ministry of Information with me, they haven't hindered my interactions with Syrians. For example, in Aleppo, there was somebody, and she sat in the side of the room, you know, and I was asking questions to, say, the doctors from the Aleppo Medical Association, which our media never deigned to interview, or when I was meeting with people in hospitals, you know. So at times there have been people from the Ministry of Information present, but that hasn't hindered my interactions. And my interactions in Damascus, I go on my own. I meet, you know, I talk with people in the markets or wherever I happen to encounter them. And maybe I'm being watched from a distance, I couldn't say. And it doesn't matter because I have one-on-one interactions with people. And, you know, in certain instances, I've video recorded them, or otherwise I've just written about what they have to say. So, you know, people can take what I write and the recordings that I have with whatever grains of salt they wish. But the point is, the Western media, BBC, CBC, whatever, that goes to Syria, they pointedly don't try to take the testimonies of people who are overtly supportive of the government or who point out the real problem in Syria is this NATO war on Syria. They phrase it differently. They say the terrorists that Erdogan has sent us, for example. And I know this, for example, one of the four times I was in Aleppo, was in, I was there twice in November, and the first trip in November, I actually joined a delegation that was organized by an Aleppo member of parliament, and this delegation comprised, I believe it was 13 other media workers, journalists, photographers, including New York Times, LA Times, and an independent woman who's for years been writing propaganda against Syria, but she joined the delegation as well. And that was the only time that that I was in some sort of government-minded delegation. But even then, you know, what we saw, so for example, on November 3rd, there was an onslaught of terrorist bombings, Grad missiles, gas canister and water heater bombs, explosive bullets, et cetera, that in the end killed 18 civilians and wounded over 200. And we happened to be at one of the main hospitals when victims were coming in. So we all saw the same thing, but people reported it in different ways. The New York Times, Anne Bernard, reported it, but then she tagged, kind of balanced it out by reporting claims based on the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is based in the UK and which has no people on the ground. They have unnamed activists on the ground. Anyway, she had to qualify the actual genuine suffering of people of Aleppo by reporting something based on the SOHR, which may or may not have had any sort of validity. And she also implied that what happened on November 3rd was random, when in fact, talking with the people, and she was there, she heard the cries of the people saying, this is happening to us every day. So this is an example of even when corporate media has access to these people, they aren't replying truthfully, you know. So and what they try to do is to say, well, independents who go there aren't able to report the whole truth. And that, in my opinion, is not the truth. I've never been hindered by the presence of anybody from the government with me.
We'll return to our conversation with independent journalist Eva Bartlett in a couple of minutes. But first, I wanted to remind our listeners that coming up in a few weeks, CKUW 95.9 FM, the community radio station which hosts the original broadcast of this program, is calling on the financial support of our loyal audiences. On the Global Research News Hour, we delve into tough subjects that other programs and other media won't touch. If you're a regular listener, you probably agree that dissident perspectives such as those from Michelle Chosadovsky, Mahdi Nazemroya, Guy McPherson, Ava Golinger, Corey Morningstar, Dmitry Orlov, Pepe Escobar, Stephen Lendman, Eve Engler, Abayomi Azikiwe, Ellen Brown, and others deserve more exposure than they typically get from mainstream or even a lot of alternative media. That's why I'm asking for your help in supporting CKUW, the radio station which has kept the Global Research News Hour a presence on the local airwaves and on the internet through podcasts. Independent media have a critical role in dismantling the mainstream media propaganda narratives which were used to justify the US-NATO military interventions in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, and now possibly wider conflicts encompassing Russia, Iran, and China. Indie media is needed to provide necessary critiques of globalization and neoliberal trade agreements that the corporate media ignores. CKUW does not accept paid ads, none whatsoever. We don't depend on corporate advertising and the elite entrenched interests which invariably distort content. We receive funding in part from the University of Winnipeg Student Union. Otherwise, we are 100% dependent on the generosity of listeners like yourself to finance the various fees, new equipment, staff salaries, and other operating costs which make it possible for the unique and informed viewpoints you hear on this program to reach the ears of the public. On behalf of the station, I encourage you to assess how important independent media is to you and donate what you can to this station or to any affiliate station which may bring our program to your radio. Winnipeg listeners are encouraged to listen to CKUW 95.9 FM between February 10th and February 17th. The Global Research News Hour airs February 17th at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. You may also donate online at fundrive.ckuw.ca. Please note that we cannot authorize tax receipts for listeners outside Canada or guarantee incentives for listeners living abroad. Thank you in advance for your support. It is greatly appreciated. Now, please stay tuned for more of our conversation with Eva Bartlett. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Maybe we should talk a little bit more, since Aleppo has been so much in the news lately. And I mean, at the same time that I understand there have been celebrations of the liberation of Aleppo on the ground, and I could think that this is something like Vanessa Bealey and others could have reported on. But we've gotten in the Western presses that, oh, you know, save Aleppo, it's a terrible disaster. And I mean, I keep getting this, you know, Amnesty International face on my feed. But given your own experiences, did you feel that you or any of the people around you were concerned about the Russian and Syrian onslaught?
Yeah, I mean, again, this is another instance where the media is manufacturing stories about Russian bombings. Of course, Russia is present in Syria at the invitation of the Syrian government, in contrast to the illegal presence of the American-led coalition that is supposedly fighting ISIS, but is accidentally dropping supplies to ISIS and allowing them to take over Syrian army positions and the city of Palmyra, as we remember. But, yeah, there have been times close calls in various parts of Syria, not just Aleppo. I've been sniped at twice. And in Aleppo, you know, getting there was dangerous. When I first went in July, the access point was a road called that went through the district of Ramusi. And on either side of the road at points, there on one side and then either side, there was a sand embankment meant to shield from sniper fire, and also an embankment of barrels and various objects also meant to shield from sniper fire from so-called rebels that were based in Sheikh Saeed just a few hundred meters beyond. So there was that, you know, the risk of being sniped at constantly. And this, I have to point out, was, you know, okay, so I had that risk a couple of times, but this is something that Syrians were enduring, you know, all the time, because this was the only access road into Aleppo. And I just want to pause here and make this point that since the so-called rebels took over pockets of Aleppo in I think it was mid-2012, there have been periods where the 1.5 million people of Greater Aleppo that the corporate media just totally disappeared. They never talked about these people. There were periods when these people were under siege and had, you know, no access to the outside world. And that meant no access to fresh food, vegetables, etc. And our media wouldn't talk about this. And, you know, so it would be, for example, this particular road going through Ramusi was cut off by the so-called rebels, and the population of Greater Aleppo was under siege. So make that point. In August, I entered Aleppo by the north along a road called Castello. And this is because, in fact, the Ramusi road had been closed due to heavy so-called rebel shelling and you know, attacks on Ramusi. And so it was closed. That road was closed because it was too dangerous to travel on. The Castello road had just been opened because the Syrian army and allies, regional allies, had just liberated that area, the areas around it. And so this is now the only road into Aleppo. And it was also dangerous because rebel or mercenary factions to the, I think it was the west, were shelling the road. So when we were leaving, there was great, like, they were mortaring the road. It was quite possible that we would have been hit. And within Aleppo itself, you know, I mentioned on a daily basis, these militant factions, these mercenaries, these terrorists, you know, invading the country, were shelling the city, and they weren't just shelling military positions. You'd think that's what they'd be doing, but just as in Damascus with the mortars that terrorists fire from Jobar or Ghouta district east of Damascus, in Aleppo also, these mercenaries were targeting parks and hospitals and universities, or the University of Aleppo, and schools and, you know, streets, public places, public spaces. And so there was always that possibility of getting hit by one of their gas canister bombs, water heater bombs. There was an explosion roughly 500 meters away. I don't know what kind of bomb it was, and I'm not sure the extent of the damage that day in July. And also an explosive bullet landed something 10, 15 meters away. So, you know, actually the day after I left, a good friend's mother was killed by one of these explosive bullets. And when I talked with the Aleppo, what's the name? Not coroner. Head of forensics there, he said that 11,000 civilians had been killed by these bombings over the past 4 or 5 years. So, you know, again, with all these fake crocodile tears for Save Aleppo and these Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch reports and tweets, they actually didn't care about the people of Greater Aleppo. They, you know, I don't remember any condemnation from them or any outrage from the United Nations about what was happening to the people of Aleppo. And I visited hospitals in Aleppo where you can find, you know, children and adults who are maimed, limbs missing, face mutilated by these attacks. You know, so you hit on a good point when you talked about these campaigns from Amnesty or, you know, Amnesty and Human Rights Watch are tied to the U.S. government. And Ken Roth, who is the director of Human Rights Watch, has repeatedly tweeted misinformation on Syria, including tweeting footage from Gaza and saying this is Aleppo and the destruction was from, you know, Assad's barrel bombs or Russian bombing, when it was clearly eastern Gaza, a district I know very well, Shijai. And, you know, he has an agenda, and that is to support the NATO agenda, which is to topple Assad and impose a puppet government in Syria. And yet, you know, these groups, whether the Human Rights Watch, Avaz, or so-called anti-war groups like Code Pink.
There's also Médecins Sans Frontières.
Absolutely. They're engaging in war propaganda. Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, was complicit in the lies about a hospital. It was actually an improvised field hospital, to my knowledge, in the Sukari district of eastern Aleppo. And earlier in, I think it was April or so, 2016, MSF came out with a report saying that due to aerial bombings from either Syria or Russian, the hospital was, quote-unquote, reduced to rubble. So, you know, reduced to rubble doesn't mean it was attacked lightly. It means it was completely leveled. And yet, some months later, The Guardian was producing reports saying this particular hospital was treating so-called victims of chemical weapons attacks. And this has been another theme over the years, to allege and accuse the Syrian government of chemical weapons attacks. And every time it's been the so-called rebels. And in this instance, The Guardian was saying, you know, chlorine attacks or something like that. And in fact, that was interesting because the rebels, the terrorists, possessed the only chlorine factory in Aleppo. But anyway, this particular hospital still stands. And there were, first we had only the imagery, the satellite imagery provided by the Russian Ministry of Defense, which showed what looked to be the hospital in the same physical a state as it was in October 2015. So, you know, the accusation of reduced to rubble was clearly false. And more recently, colleagues of mine were in eastern Aleppo, and they went to that specific field hospital, and they were inside it. So it's intact, and it was operational as of, I believe it was July 2016. So, you know, Médecins Sans Frontières doesn't have staff on the ground. They, like the UN, like all the media, are relying on unnamed activists for their information, or they're relying on completely and overtly biased Al-Qaeda-affiliated white helmets, so-called Syrian civil defense.
Effectively, there have been these campaigns against you, and I know that you, to a lot of people, you came under fire after that presentation at the UN. They took a couple of comments that I kind of struck me as being just almost as asides, and like they just jumped on them and you use them as to smear everything else that you've documented, photographed, interviews, all of that. Is we should just ignore it because of a couple of you know, comments in passing that you made.
Yeah.
Would you like to address that in any way?
Absolutely. Thank you. It's interesting that Snopes, Channel 4 UK, which has been one of the heaviest war propagandists in terms of, you know, Western British media, and a few others have written or created these smear campaigns against me. First of all, the articles that they've written don't just address minute aspects of what I said, but they also, you know, tag in things like conspiracy theorist or other things totally meant to discredit my person. And they use strawman arguments wherein they take out of context or they mix things that I've said to confuse people. So I will admit that I could have phrased things better with regard to the issue of children being used in media manipulation. I still stand by the fact that children are being used in media manipulation, and we shouldn't be surprised because, you know, this has happened in other instances, and even in December, Egypt arrested a group of people who were staging what was to be Aleppo videos, and they had a little girl dressed in white with what looked to be blood but had to be paint, and the Egyptian authorities arrested these people. So, you know, this could have been yet another video produced to say this is Aleppo under Assad or Russian bombing. The thing that I mentioned, a girl who looks to be appearing in a few different situations, I cannot definitively prove that. However, it seems quite possible that she's appeared in at least two different videos, but I can't prove that. I am, however, looking into that, and, you know, I think a forensic video analysis could say whether or not this has been the case. But the point being, the videos that that this girl and the videos being produced are produced by either the White Helmets, who are funded with $100 million from the West, and, as I mentioned, work only in Al-Qaeda areas, and were founded by a British ex-military officer, or they're being produced by the Aleppo Media Center, which is also funded by the West and is not, you know, neutral and impartial. But the other point about that whole conference, so I could have phrased things better, I admit, you know, but I still maintain that there's the possibility, and certainly media manipulation is occurring. One other point I want to make about the White Helmets very quickly. I wasn't aware of this whole mannequin challenge thing, but somebody, one of the White Helmets members, submitted one of their own videos to this mannequin challenge, in which I guess people are supposed to act as if they're mannequins. And it just shows this video, I don't believe, was crafted to participate in the mannequin challenge video, but it does show that the White Helmets videos are very clearly staged. And in fact, recently, one former White Helmets member came out and admitted that he joined thinking that he was joining what they call civil defense, and at some point he was asked to start acting in some of their productions, and he was saying, why do we need to act? And they said, because we won't get the money from our funders in, you know, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Europe. And he repeated this a couple of times, that he and several others were asking, why do we have to act? And the same answer was that, you know, it's all about getting our money. And he also made a mention of children being in some of these videos, and children were acting. So, I mean, you know, we have to take his testimony also with a grain of salt. Was he being genuine or not in it? But this testimony actually is in a video produced by Anna News, who were on the ground in East Aleppo, and they were at the headquarters of the White Helmets. It's a quite interesting video. But back to the whole UN thing. So these smear campaign articles focused only on the Aya comment, the girl, and the Quds Hospital. Now, the Quds Hospital, I was only wrong in saying that it hadn't been attacked, because I can't prove that it hasn't been attacked. But what I was correct in general in saying is that, you know, it hasn't been reduced to rubble, and that was the claim of the media, and that was the claim of NSF. Now, these articles did not address any of the other issues that I made, any other points I made in the, say, 25, 30-minute long UN press conference, or the points made by my colleagues on the panel, some of whom have been to Syria. You know, and the points also were about what I've said just in our interview about the life for the 1.5 million-plus people in Aleppo, the attacks, and other areas of Syria, which I spoke of. And clearly, the point that they focused on this girl and the Quds Hospital, it was clearly meant just to be defamatory and discredit me. And it may have worked, but it's interesting, if you look at the comments on Channel 4, people aren't buying their propaganda. A lot of the comments are saying, look, we know that you're lying. With Snopes, their article was full of these straw men arguments and also personal attacks, including that conspiracy theorist comment, and completely conflating things. I'm going to be issuing a rebuttal. I'm working on it. I've been quite busy. But I'm going to be issuing a rebuttal, kind of looking at both the Snopes and Channel 4 arguments and showing, you know, where their fallacies are. And Snopes itself, I mean, there's some interesting articles out about Snopes and their own compromised, you know, issues and engagements right now. They're said to be a fact-checking site, and yet they, in fact, in an earlier article referencing some of Vanessa Beely's work on 21st Century Wire with regards to the White Helmets, Snopes completely dismissed the fact that White Helmets operate in Al-Qaeda areas and operate with terrorists and include members of terrorist factions. So Snopes seems to have their own agenda. So, you know, their attack piece on me is itself not credible.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So it seems Yeah, there's more to fact-checking than simply going to one of these sorts of sites. And I would just say to our listeners that, you don't necessarily have to agree with Ava Bartlett, but I think that before you judge her, you should at least check out her reporting. Read the reports that on her site, ingaza.wordpress.com. And judge them on their merits. Please don't dismiss her because she because of a hit piece on Snopes or because she published something on a so-called fake news site called by certainly the usual suspects. Ava, I think we've got to wrap up now. Is there anything else you'd like to say, either about the tour or anything else we've touched on before we go?
Thanks for mentioning that. Colleagues and, anti-war activists are organizing for me to give some talks in Hamilton on the 24th and 5th, in Ottawa on the 27th, in Montreal on the 28th. And I think that a member of Global Research may be on one of the panels, and also perhaps Stephen Gowans may be on one of the panels. I hope so. I highly, aside from what I've reported, I highly recommend that listeners look at the writings of Stephen Gowans. It's incredibly coherent and articulate and gives a lot of historical context that people need to understand how events have come about in Syria. I'd also really encourage people to look for the writings of Tim Anderson and his book on Syria. Again, he's been in Syria. He's highly articulate and has researched very well. And, with regard to Aleppo, I just say, of course, please look at Syrian reporters, because there are reporters who do report in English. Muhammad Ali reports for Press TV, Ala Ibrahim as well. And there have been other independent people who have gone to Aleppo, particularly during its liberation, Vanessa Bealey, Jan Oberg, Andrew Ashdown. So there's a number of sources. What I do, I don't look at one source. Obviously, I cross-reference, and people do not have to believe everything I'm saying. Look at other sources, and you'll find a lot of correlations and corroborations. Thanks very much for having me on and giving me this time to talk a little bit about Syria.
Well, thank you very much. We've been joined by Ava Bartlett. She is an independent writer, journalist, and rights activist. Her website is ingaza.wordpress.com. To shed further light on the Syrian crisis, I'm joined by the aforementioned Stephen Gowans. He writes on a number of subjects, is author of the popular blog What's Left, and he is the author of the soon-to-be-released book Washington's Long War on Syria. He joins us from Ottawa. Thank you once again for joining us, Stephen Gowans.
Thank you, Michael.
I'm going to start with a quote from an article written by Ashley Smith of the International Socialist Organization for Counterpunch, which I think encapsulates a lot of the thinking from the anti-imperialist left on Syria. This is the quote: "A genuine internationalist left must stand with Syria's popular resistance to Assad, which began as a nonviolent uprising against the dictatorship and against intervention by American and Russian imperialism, as well as by the region's main powers. How could opponents of U.S. imperialism end up supporting a dictator, one who has been known to collaborate with the U.S. in torturing war on terror prisoners in the CIA's extraordinary rendition program?" Unquote. So, Stephen, maybe you could start by correcting the record on this popular resistance and its origins, it seems, in Daraa in 2011. What evidence is there that this revolution from its beginnings was not what people like Ashley Smith are leading us to believe?
I've often heard people talk about this as a popular, nonviolent uprising. And I went back to press coverage in the months and weeks immediately following this so-called uprising to look at what was going on, to look at what the New York Times and the Washington Post and Time magazine were saying. And what I discovered was that in the weeks and months preceding that riot, those newspapers and those media organizations were saying, look, there's an uprising throughout the Arab world, but nothing's happening in Syria. Why is nothing happening in Syria? There was a Facebook page that was created at the beginning of 2011 in Syria called the Syrian Revolution, and it called for days of rage demonstrations to be held early in the year.
those demonstrations came off, but barely anyone attended them. They fizzled. And those people who did go to the demonstrations usually chanted slogans that pertained to Gaddafi, who at the time was kind of locked into a war with what we now know were Islamists. And so the Time reporters and the New York Times reporters started scratching their heads and looking into the reasons why it was that there was little revolutionary distemper in Syria where there seemed to be elsewhere in the Arab world. And what they discovered was that the Syrian government had a considerable amount of popular support. So they said, you know, Assad is very popular, and even his critics concede that. He's endeared himself to the public. He espouses positions that the public support. And there's little chance, according to Syrians, that there's going to be an uprising in Syria. Well, then we did have a riot or a series of riots that begin about March 17th in the town of Dera. And if you look at the reports in March 17th, March 18th, coming from mainline Western newspapers about what was going on, they say U.S. officials have acknowledged that this was, or these were violent riots. So there were men seen at the riots who were bearing arms. Buildings were burned down. Governor's office was burned down. The Ba'ath Party headquarters was burned down. Two cell phone company buildings were burned down. Vehicles were burned. There were clashes with police. These were riots involving a few hundred people. It wasn't a mass uprising of thousands or tens of thousands of people, and it wasn't nonviolent. This is even acknowledged by U.S. officials. The established or their correspondent Robert Fisk, who's well known, Robert Fisk also wrote of seeing videos taken at these demonstrations that showed people bearing arms and pistols. So the uprising wasn't popular because it involved only hundreds of people. The demands weren't for Assad to step down. The demands related to the release of political prisoners and an end to wartime measures. And the New York Times and Time soon reported that the riots, there became a series of riots that broke out, and the riots had Islamist content. At no point can you read in any of these Western media accounts of anyone talking about fundamental changes to the political and economic system.
So I'm wondering if there was a trigger event that made 2011 the time for this to happen. Is there, was it having to do with pipelines? Was it the, something that, maybe developments around coming with regard to Russia? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, some people, or many people, often think that the United States is only interested in ousting the Syrian government and forcing Assad to step down from 2011. But as Patrick Coburn, the Middle East correspondent, has pointed out, the United States has long wanted to get rid of Assad. They wanted to get rid of Assad's father, who was his predecessor as president. In 2001, you may recall that U.S. General Wesley Clark told Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman that the Pentagon had drawn up plans to invade seven countries, including Iraq, Libya, and Syria. 2002, Syria was added to the Bush administration's Axis of Evil regime change hit list, and Washington said, Syria was developing weapons of mass destruction in the same way Iraq was supposed to have done, and that it was supporting terrorism. Then in 2005, the U.S. Congressional Research Service reported that the U.S. government was actively weighing regime change in Syria. And they said the impetus for pursuing regime change was to sweep away an impediment to the achievement of U.S. goals in the Middle East related to strengthening Israel, because the Syrian government is an implacable opponent of Israel, consolidating U.S. domination of Iraq, because Syria was opposed to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and also fostering open market and free enterprise economies. If you look at U.S. Documents, say from the Congressional Research Service or from the State Department, you'll see lots of complaints about Syrian economic policy. Syrian economic policy, or Syria, is often being branded as a socialist country in the United States. Some people would say, well, we don't really believe it's socialist. Marxists might say that. But it's clear that the U.S. government believes that Syria has pursued socialist policies. 2007, the Muslim Brotherhood teamed up with the former Syrian vice president to found something called the National Salvation Front. The National Salvation Front frequently met with the U.S. State Department and the U.S. National Security Council and had two meetings at the White House. They're also receiving funding from the Middle East, or the U.S. government-funded Middle East Partnership Initiative, and it's been reported in the Washington Post that, you know, the opposition to the secular Arab nationalist government in Syria have been receiving funding from the United States since at least 2005. So what were the reasons? Why did the United States want to ally with this opposition? I should also mention that in 2005, the Congressional Research Service said that the United States had actually intended to invade Syria immediately following its invasion of Iraq, but it discovered that its hands were full with the occupation of Iraq, its resources were stretched too thin, and that it had to abandon its plans to actually invade Syria and instead pursue this kind of regime change policy in which they would ally with Islamists to overthrow the secular Arab nationalist government. So what's the impetus? The impetus is to do in Syria exactly what was done in Iraq, which is to, quote, de-ba'athify the country, which is essentially remove the secular Arab nationalist influence from Syria, as it was done from Iraq, and to prevent it from ever coming back. So, I mean, if Assad was forced to step down, we should ask the question, why is it that the United States is so interested in having Assad step down? It's not really Assad that they want to step down. Who they want to step down are secular Arab nationalists who pursue policies which are at odds with kind of the Wall Street-friendly economic policies that the United States favors in the world. Also, the United States, I mean, this is quite clear if you read any U.S. strategy documents, that the United States regards itself as the self-appointed leader of a global political and economic order. The secular Arab nationalists in Washington have made it quite clear that they now have no intention of falling in behind Washington as leader of a global economy, that they prize their independence, they prize their economic sovereignty, and they don't intend to, as Assad once put it, make Syrians work for the benefit of U.S. corporations and U.S. banks and investors.
Mm. I want to thank you for enlightening us in this regard, Stephen. And your book is coming out when exactly?
It will be released in April, April 17th, I believe.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Stephen Gowans is the author of the soon-to-be-released book Washington's Long War on Syria and of the popular blog What's Left, which can be found at gowans.wordpress.com. He joined us from Ottawa.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Bye for now.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.